Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of The Way Life Should Be. I am your host, John Q. Publius.
We have Jessica Isabel Robeson with us. We are kind of going to discuss a little bit of your background and upbringing and some of the things that you witnessed there that kind of led to your, let's say, political and worldview evolution. Do you want to just kind of give us the spark notes real quick?
Yeah, I'll give you the overview. So I was born in the UK to British parents, but when I was two, my father got a job with the UN's refugee agency, and we moved to Botswana in Southern Africa, and then every 3 to 4 years, we moved country. So in order, throughout my childhood, I lived in Botswana, Zimbabwe, France and Switzerland, kind of like right on the border between the two countries, then the US in Washington, D.C., then in Turkey, and then my parents went back to France, Switzerland again. And by that time, I was growing up and living in London. And as you might imagine, with a father as a refugee worker, and my mother also then started working for various sort of human rights and humanitarian NGOs, I was very much immersed in the sort of humanitarian human rights community. So the only views I ever really heard were to do with, you know, well, I mean, some of it was fine. Some of it was sort of, you know, trying to fight genuine oppression and sort of, I suppose, genuine racism and stuff. But these were the only views I ever heard. And it was largely this kind of broad idea of, you know, the West is evil and needs to atone and the rest of the world is all good. And I remember first time I became politically aware, I was very small. We moved to Zimbabwe when I was six, right after independence. So right after the civil war and the end of Rhodesia. And you did still see a lot of the sort of the hostility around, you know, there was lots of aggro between the sort of the white farmers still and some of the black population. And this was presented to me very simplistically, as in, you know, the white farmers were absolutely completely 100% bad and everything any of the black Zimbabweans did was good. Didn't question it then, because I just, you know, was a small child and just, you know, believed whatever my parents told me. Did start to question it, of course, a bit later, and certainly now I look back and realize it wasn't as simple as that by any stretch of the imagination. But I'm still basically pretty naive until, you know, all throughout my childhood, or certainly very conventionally left-wing, until I was 17 when we moved to Turkey, to the Turkish capital Ankara in the early 90s, and that was hideous. My sisters and I were all treated just, well, like white whores, basically. Really like the worst racism of anyone I've ever come across, actually. I've read about worst cases of racism, but I've never met anyone that experienced worse than what me and my sisters went through. I was 17, but my sisters were, when we went, 11, 12, and 4. And even the 4-year-old didn't escape some of it, you know. And it was just because we were white, it was because we were very fair. And the men, just every single time we left the house, we were just unbelievably harassed, you know. Catcalled, jeered, hissed at, spat at, touched, laughed at, I mean, everything, you name it. My 11-year-old sister had sperm thrown on her, and she didn't know what it was, you know, and so she kind of went home and washed this stuff off, and it was only years later that she realised. And this was just pure racism. We were nothing but just white whores to them and just a joke. And this was very, very disturbing for us, as you might imagine. And the reason why that was a real wake-up call for me wasn't just experiencing it, but it was just that I told my parents, and my father in particular, and my father just didn't want to hear it. My father, the big, you know, refugee human rights worker, it just didn't fit with his, you know, narrative and his worldview. He didn't want to accept that it was so severe. When we went out with him, he didn't see it because we were his property then, so they left us alone. And he just decided we were making it up, and he turned on us, and my family started to fracture as a result of it. And that was the first time I really kind of thought, what's the point in spouting all this ideology and these beliefs if you don't even, if you can't even act upon on them now when your own daughters are suffering it? And he wasn't the only one. I mean, his colleagues and, you know, all the people that I met, we talked to all of them about it, and they all pretty much said the same thing. They all tried to rationalize it and explain it and say, oh, maybe you misunderstood, or you have to be accepting of these people's culture, and all the usual rationalizations. And these are people who would not accept somebody black being racially harassed in London because of their skin color, but it was fine for us to be racially harassed because we needed to be understanding. So that was definitely the beginnings of me thinking, no, there's something wrong with this worldview. And that kind of continued really throughout my youth. I came to London then and, yeah, continued to be treated like complete shit. We continued to be treated very badly. But
that's okay. We have it's uncensored.
I can swear. Good.
Yes.
I'm supposed to try to not be swearing anymore, but there we are. I'm failing sometimes. But it wasn't just, you know, in London, Muslim men and to a lesser extent, Caribbean men, not African men, but Caribbean men also treated me just like shit because I was white. And I just thought, no, this is not okay. You know, I mean, and I was understanding up to a point of why they thought white women were like that, given the way, you know, white women are portrayed and stuff sometimes in the media. But I just thought it's not okay. And again, every time I tried to speak to people about it, you know, lefty liberal types at university, they just say, oh, well, cut your hair short and dye it or something, you know. I just thought, nah, you're not going to tell black people to bleach their skin. So why are you telling white women to kind of change their hair, you know? That was the beginning. I still stayed pretty left and liberal for a while. But, you know, it just, once the chinks had been made, you know, it all started to unravel. And then, you know, as I've grown up, I've just continued to see and hear about constant racism from these people towards white women. The worst one, of course, being the rape gangs that operate all across the UK and other European countries, which are absolutely a problem to do with race, and nobody wants to accept that it is at the moment. So, yeah, and my parents might have wanted to raise me to be a bit of a hippie like them, but it had the opposite view, had the opposite effect, I'm afraid. And I think I haven't seen anything change in the human rights and humanitarian world. They haven't reflected upon these things. They're still stuck to the same narrative. And it's a narrative which is now, you know, doing huge damage because it's still this narrative of everyone who is poor or everybody who wants to leave and escape poverty or escape persecution has an automatic right to come to us and we have to help them and they're only suffering and we're only privileged. And this simplistic kind of, you know, dichotomy is still the same. And as a result, I have to say that I've lost a lot of respect, if not all of it, for that world, you know. I mean, there ought to be a way that they could, there ought to be a way they could have grown up by now, I suppose, and just, you know, become a bit more nuanced in their understanding of these things, but they're not. They're still stuck to this mantra, basically, of white people evil, everyone else good, and it's just not working anymore. It's one of the reasons.
Yeah,
carry on, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's one of the reasons why a couple of years back I decided I would just start writing publicly about this stuff, because no one seemed to understand who aid workers are or what they can be like or what the world they operate in is like. And I just thought, I've got to start speaking up about this because I've got this kind of unique experience of it, you know. One of the times I went most public was last year or was it the year before, I can't remember now, when the Oxfam prostitution scandal broke, you know, the Oxfam guys using the child prostitutes in Haiti.
Yes.
And lots of people were just totally shocked by that, especially in the UK. And I think Oxfam was created here and everyone's very proud of it and stuff. But I wasn't remotely surprised. I thought, yeah, of course they're using child prostitutes. I mean, I've seen this happening growing up, you know. It was open knowledge that UN workers would go to local prostitutes, certainly. And I'm certain some of those were children. So we just sort of knew this stuff was happening. And I knew that aid workers weren't good people necessarily. So I was a bit confused that people were so shocked, and I thought, okay, well, I'll just go public with some of my experiences. And people were very, very, very interested to hear it. So I thought, okay, I'll just keep talking about it and, you know, publish and be damned, really. If people need to know, you know, we give huge amounts of money to these institutions, either voluntarily to charitable ones like Oxfam, or we're forced to, you know, with donations to the UN. And I think that people need to know that they're not doing the work that they say they're doing, or else that they are, but that work is working against the West now, and that we have a right to say no to it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, so I start being public on that. I don't mean to say by that I think it's all bad. I mean, I'd still be in favor of obviously helping out people with earthquakes and sort of tsunamis and things. I think there's basic, you know, human compassion can come in, but I think particularly the human rights lot are becoming quite sinister and totalitarian now. It's this one-size-fits-all approach, which of course is understandable, it's human rights, but human rights came out of the European Enlightenment and they're fundamentally pegged to European culture or Enlightenment culture, and trying to apply them in the same way to fundamentally different cultures is not working. Classic example being, you know, freedom of religion and Islamic immigration. You know, Muslim immigrants come to the West, they expect to be able to practice their religion openly, We think, yes, of course, that sounds perfectly reasonable on the face of it. But then we realize, actually, that doesn't mean going to church and singing hymns to Jesus. It means, you know, expanding a very dominant and totalitarian political and religious system, which is fundamentally opposed to human rights. So there's this horrible tension being created between, on the one hand, people, you know, these immigrants sort of religious rights, and on the other hand, everyone else's human rights. And that tension is about to fray and break, I think. At the moment, everyone's pretending it's going to work, but it's not going to work. And a good example of that, I think, is Islam and gay rights. And that's coming to the boil in the UK, because you've got Muslims who are asserting their religious rights to, for example, not have their children educated about gay rights and transgender issues. And on the other hand, you've got the gay lobby saying, but this is a fundamental issue of human rights, and if you want to live in this kind of society, you have to learn about it, etc., etc. And there's no solution at the moment. Muslim parents in one city, Birmingham, are at one point, I think, 600 students were removed from one of the schools. I think it was that high, because they refused to have their children learn this stuff, which is part of the national curriculum, which means that you should, by law, be forced to learn it. They just refused. And the government's backed down so far. So they've won, basically. And the left are not saying anything about this. You know, the left that pretends to be all in favour of gay rights is not saying anything about it. So we'll see. And that's obviously, if they've won this one, they'll win the next one. They'll just get more and more emboldened by it, really. And I don't know where it will all end. But I think, well, I know it will all end in the sense that I think the left-wing political parties will abandon gay men or gay people to the Islamic lobby, because the Islamic lobby is just much, much bigger. So that's going to be a big problem for the left, because they very much like to see themselves as obviously very much in favour of gay rights and stuff. And they see it as one of their quite achievements, but they're about to let it all go to nothing, I think. So that's one example.
You're right. It's all these fascinating kind of competing interest groups. It'll be very curious to see how that all shakes out. And, you know, it's those groups, if it happens in that way, the gays are certainly not going to have a soft landing, because they've been so sort of antagonistic towards heterosexual whites, frankly, who have been at the forefront of giving them these rights, you know? So it's like you've spent all this time hectoring and harassing and forcing this. I don't know how bad it is in the UK. I would imagine it's quite bad, where it's really crossed the Rubicon from being education and almost into indoctrination. So it's like with multiculturalism, it's not accepting. It's just you always ceding ground. And it's almost forced on people. I mean, we could see, children being taken away from their parents if they don't want to do the whole transgender thing, which scientifically, I don't get too deep in the weeds on this because I have a few comments on what you had just said too, but scientifically, it's very, very harmful for the children, because it interferes not just with their normal physical developmental patterns, but with their neurological development and even cognitive ability. Like there have been a couple of studies, and I'm thinking of one in particular that showed I think it was a boy who thought he was a girl or whatever, and they had basically hindered his testosterone development and gave him estrogen, and he suffered like a 9 IQ point loss because he wasn't getting the normal male neuroprotective testosterone that he needed for his brain as a biological male. So it's actually making people, I don't know what the effects are on women. I know the physiological effects, the neurological effects, I'm not sure, but the cognitive development of men or boys who are male, obviously, saying that they're female and having their, you know, and as preteens and teens, and in some cases even, you know, quite young, having their normal developmental patterns interrupted with this stuff. Because, I mean, these are powerful sex hormones. Of course they're going to have effects, but we're talking about even at the risk of people's cognitive development. I mean, that's really terrifying. But, you know, there are a couple other things I was going to say. We can kind of circle back to that. But one thing I found really interesting was when you were talking about Turkey, they're always held up as sort of the most secular and westernized of all of the Islamic countries. And yet you encountered, just as you said, some of the most brutal naked racism that you could imagine.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, it wasn't necessarily even from religious guys either. It's just a cultural thing, you know. It's just pure cultural racism towards white people. They just think white women are whores, you know, it's that simple. And they've got it from whatever, from the pornography they watch, from the films they watch, wherever they've got it from, I don't know, but it's basic, absolute racial stereotyping and then acting upon it in an absolutely obscene way, in a way you just don't see in the West. You just do not see racism like that in the West. Or when you do, it's so scandalous, it makes the front page news and there's government investigations into it, you know. But this was absolutely daily, every single time we left the house. And yeah, sure, Turkey is held up as an example of that. And it was for a while. I mean, they tried to sort of not ban Islam, but really, you know, Atatürk, the guy who sort of, you know, ran Turkey after the World War One and turned it into this modern secular republic, he tried to basically stop Islam. He saw this backward and stuff, and he tried to westernize Turkey. But it worked for a little while, but it's not working anymore. As I'm sure you're aware, the new guy, Atatürk, Erdogan, is very, very pro the Islamists. He's courting them, he's allowing kind of, you know, Islam back into institutions and into politics. So basically Turkey's returning to source, it's becoming Islamic again. So no, it's a complete nonsense just because it's secular and democratic, nominally secular and democratic, that means it's somehow a Western country. It just isn't, no way. Right. Yeah, no way at all. Very dangerous country, Turkey, I think, because at the moment in particular as well, they're the kind of the key to Europe. They've got the bottleneck on all these Syrian and Iraqi migrants wanting to come into Europe. And Erdogan has said many times he, you know, was quite willing to flood Europe with Muslims to destroy us. He's openly said it. So, you know, he's not ashamed of it. And I wouldn't put him past him to do it either. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a politically advantageous move for him. I mean, he can pressure not just the European governments into concessions. I mean, look at, for example, the way the European Union, which is supposedly all about, you know, again, human rights and things, just let Turkey walk into Cyprus. Like, there's been no, and they're continually antagonizing not just Cyprus, but Greece. And people say nothing about it. And furthermore, Erdogan is able to sort of goad the export Turkish populations in places like Germany to do, he's basically exercising power as a foreign lobby. Mexico does this in the United States too. But the governments seem paralyzed, unable, unwilling to address it at all.
And that to me is the very definition of a colony. If you have a population inside your country that is of foreign origin, however you want to put it, that is actively loyal to a foreign country, a foreign ideology, a foreign regime, and is doing its work inside your country, that is a colony. It's a hostile colony. And not only that, but, you know, the Turks fund mosques in certainly the Netherlands, I think maybe Germany as well. So you've actually got, a hostile country like Turkey funding hostile mosques inside European countries. And we're just told this is all fine because they were born here and they're immigrants and they have human rights. And you're like, okay, great. So at what point is this going to blow? But yeah, I mean, Turkey is disaster, really. And I mean, there are Turks all over Europe. Certainly the Netherlands, Holland, Germany, and certainly quite a lot in London as well. And they are not loyal to this country, not in any way, shape or form. None of them are. I mean, you probably saw the celebrations after, I think, Algeria won the Africa Cup or something. Algeria won some big football tournament a couple of weeks ago. And all these Algerians just, you know, were kind of, OK, I'm one level celebrating, but also sort of semi-rioting all over Paris and indeed London, openly talking about how, you know, they're sort of, you know, they're proud to sort of, you know, proud because they won, you know. And if we said, okay, so you're Algerian, then you're supporting Algeria, you consider yourself Algerian, they would say yes. If we then say, okay, fine, you're Algerian, so don't take our state benefits, don't have our citizenship, you know, don't have this, right, then we'd be racist and white supremacist and whatnot. But to me, it was the sheer number of them, and you expected it in Paris, but I just couldn't believe how many Algerians and North Africans there were in London. And it was just like, there's no historical connection to these countries. You know, we didn't colonize North Africa. We were enslaved by North Africans, but we didn't colonize them or anything. There were no connections between the UK and French-speaking North Africa, yet here are massive colonies of them all over London, openly proclaiming their support to Algeria. And no one's saying anything. It's all just a lovely celebration. Isn't it nice watching them all, you know, celebrate their football match? And you're like, no, that's not really. But we're supposed to pretend it is. So yeah, there we are. Had it gone to that, yeah. Colonies of Muslims inside Europe, and I think we do have to start calling them colonies because they are not all. Some are loyal to the European countries, but most are not. You know,
and that. Yeah, means- I read some statistic. It was like more Muslims have joined ISIS than have joined the British military.
A large factor. Yeah, I did. I think four times as many. It's something like only 600. Muslims have joined the British military, but it's over 2,000, I think, have joined just ISIS. Yeah, that's not including sort of any of the other groups, and that's not including sort of less militant groups. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And it's what adds another level of ridiculousness to it is then all of like our countries are pretty simpatico when it comes to foreign policy, and then they go and they do things that embolden ISIS. And but they have their own so-called nationals, or at the very least, people they're giving asylum to, going and fighting. You know, we're supposedly combating ISIS, except like the U.S. is providing funds to ISIS, and it's just it's a complete horror show. And you see, like again, another one of these big Wahhabi exporters, Saudi Arabia, is allied with the U.S. The U.S. sends them arms and all this stuff, and then they say, "Oh, we're trying to combat you know this kind of ideology," and it's just they're talking out of both sides of their mouth, and it's completely absurd. The whole thing has just gotten, it's like, you know, I'm not a big football fan, but when the World Cup was going on, I sort of semi paid attention, and you had these ridiculous stories of, you know, I guess France won and that it's basically the African team. There's like no French people on it. And that's, you know, a celebration of multiculturalism. You have the other thing. It's like, oh, here are Switzerland's two best players. And it's like two Albanians. And you're like, what is that? Like, it's not even the World Cup. It's a farce. And it was in stark display. You had like Iceland, Croatia, Russia, who actually had Icelandic, Croatian, and Russian people on their team, versus these sort of hodgepodge, amalgam of who knows what on you know France and even Switzerland and some of these others, and it's kind of like, yes, people are going to probably criticize me for this, but I do like basketball, and you look at in the National Basketball Association in the NBA in the US, you'll see like German player so-and-so and you look and the guy's like coal black. You're like, come on, like seriously. And there's a guy, he's one of the better players actually in the league. He's got a Greek name, but he's actually Nigerian but they call him the Greek freak, I think is his nickname. I'm like, you look at him, you're like, this guy's not Greek. I mean, come on. Yeah. Like, it's ridiculous.
It is, but the thing that also fascinates me about that is so when, as you say, France wins the World Cup and it's all down to these African players, it's, hey, great, wonderful, multiculturalism, yada, yada, France, be grateful. Like, okay, fine, yeah, all their football team is African. Who's in their prisons, you know? Who's on their welfare state? There's an overrepresentation there too, but we never look at that, do we? You know, we only ever look at, you know, where there's positive examples of where immigrants have done things, but never look at the downsides. And that's what I always say. I'm like, okay, fine, celebrate the fact that loads of Africans are winning the World Cup for you if you want, but are you also then going to celebrate the fact that they're massively overrepresented in crime and prison and welfare dependency and all this sort of stuff as well? Because there's a diversity problem there too, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And the other thing that I always find fascinating about it is if you see an all-white lineup or an all-white team, this is terrible. This is, you know, they need more diversity. Da 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 da. No one ever complains about the lack of diversity in the 100 meters final. You know, no one's complaining there. This is black supremacy. This is appalling. Oh my God, we have to change this. Only ever when you see white people being represented somewhere.
Oh yeah, yeah. I only see in the major American sports, football, American football. Basketball, baseball, and hockey. You never hear it about football or basketball, and the leagues are roughly about three quarters black each. But you do hear it about baseball, and you really hear it about hockey. And it's like, you guys, but they talk about like, you know, the culture of the inner cities, and it lends itself to basketball and stuff. It's like, okay, well, the culture of Minnesota and Canada and, you know, Slovakia that produces hockey players, like those produce people who grow up on ice and around ice and they play hockey. Like, why is this a problem for you? Well, we know it's a problem. Like you said, it only goes one way.
Nicely, yeah. And there's absolutely no problem with that. There's absolutely no problem with certain sort of cultures and races liking particular things more than others. It's always been that way. The most ridiculous example I saw of that, you might have come across it, was a minor Twitter spat about how knitting is horribly white supremacy.
Yes.
And you just think, because apparently there's loads of like women on Pinterest, nice American women who do their knitting and put the pictures on Pinterest, and they all tend to be white. And as a result, this is terrible. And you just think, for heaven's sake, you're going after people doing knitting. I mean, this is ridiculous. Nothing's stopping black people knitting if they want to. Maybe they don't want to, you know?
Right.
Maybe that's...
It's like the outdoors. Like, we have, I think, like, maybe 1% of our national park visitors are black. It's like, okay, that's just not something they're into. So, but how is that an issue? Like, I mean, well, it is an issue in the sense that obviously then you have a population that's not as concerned with conservation, but why is that an issue that like white and actually Asian people are going out and enjoying the great outdoors? I mean, that is the national park. We do pay for it. Yeah. And plus you pay on entry if you're going. So how is this a quote problem? Well, again, it's like any place where we can kind of be ourselves and have our own spaces is an issue. And we talked about this on the show, The Third Rail I'm On, is like, they're always trying to implicate things that are implicitly, you know, white spaces. So for example, I don't play video games, but video games, and actually I suppose Asians are probably involved in that too, but video games, or there's certain types of music or certain types of subcultures. You mentioned knitting. I saw one recently about craft beer. It's like, what are you going to say? Okay, rap has a black people problem. That it's like, it is that ridiculous.
Precisely. No one ever says, oh my God, rap's so black, this is terrible. I mean, everyone understands where it comes from, and that's fine. You know, it's absolutely rooted to urban black culture. Fine, no problem, go for it. Classical music is rooted to kind of upper class European whites. Fine, no problem, you know. It doesn't have to be an issue. And of course, the interesting thing about it all, as I'm preaching to the converted here, is it's destroying real diversity. I mean, real diversity is exactly that, how human cultures and races are different and have these huge variety of interests and things that they get on with, and that's where all the interest lies. But so instead you could actually celebrate, I hate that term, but you know what I mean, you could celebrate that sort of real diversity, but instead it's no, got to change that, and then you end up forcing you know, a situation and then ruining it for everybody. And yeah. It's just ridiculous. But seeing them going after nice middle-aged sort of, you know, elderly American women doing knitting for their grandchildren, I just thought, this is absolutely ridiculous now, you know?
Yeah, it is that one size fits all paradigm, as you talked about. And it's like, it all has to be within their frame of reference too. So as long as it advances some sort of, you know, consumerist agenda, then it's fine. And so if you could see them attacking, say, the great outdoors, like there's no, I mean, yes, you pay, as I said, a fee to go to a park, a national park, but you're doing that for the upkeep of the grounds, the trails and the park rangers, so that people aren't like, you know, polluting and killing the animals and stuff there. But you're not doing it in a way that it's just empty consumerism, but that's what they want. So they want this sort of homogenous consumer ideology. It's like the export of McDonald's, for example. They just, everywhere, I think there's only like 6 or 7 countries in the world that don't have a McDonald's. And it's like, well, everyone can eat at McDonald's and sell, but they always go through the food too. And we might've even talked about this last time. It's always like food and sports. And it's like, that's pretty much all they have that they're constantly using as examples. And I saw this with another guy who was trying to push, because it's not just, it is mostly white countries, but they also want the kind of high trust ones in Northeast Asia as well. They're angling for them. And you see them hit Japan pretty hard. And there was like some mixed race tennis player who did really well. And so this journalist was like, this is why we need immigration to Japan. It's like, excuse me, what? Cause one tennis player.
This is it.
Okay. That's it. But they rely on people being so brainwashed and so dumb, frankly, that they just go, oh yeah, that makes sense. And it's like, you know, to some degree, we all sort of are fine with the live and let live philosophy. And I think to a large degree, that's fair. It's not like you want to go around invading people's privacy to make sure that they're totally on board with whatever you're pushing. But they take something that is sort of something that is palatable, like the idea of, okay, you know, that there are these different cultures, and it's, as you mentioned, the kind of human biodiversity, like Algeria has Algerian culture, and, you know, Brazil has Brazilian culture and what have you, and then taking that and just sort of jamming it into their own paradigm, which is, yes, multiculturalism, but not really. It's actually total uniformity. And eventually, in this crucible of materialism, you just have a bunch of people with no real sense of identity or place who are just buying shit and working for no money. There's no workers' rights. There's no nothing. It's just they're streaming stuff and they're working for nothing. And you have a teeny little percentage of people at the top who control everything. And it's, you know, it's very insidious. It's very insidious.
is the most insidious bit about it, the way after a couple of generations of, you know, education and indoctrination, people are just willingly, you know, bleating for their own destruction. That's the thing that's most sinister to me, you know, the way it absolutely has got people's minds now. They can't think anymore. They can't think critically about it anymore. And they're certainly not prepared to think uncomfortably about it. But it is. It's just going to end up being this uniformity everywhere. I mean, seeing migration being, especially Islamic migration, being pushed on Japan is just so sinister as far as I'm concerned. Because, I mean, Japan is one of the few countries that's managed to stay homogenous and true to its culture. And Japan has a truly unique culture. You have to like all of it, but it is unique and it's Japanese and it has every right to exist. And I do not see Islam and Japan working well together at all. You know, I don't see how they could possibly merge together. But it's being pushed on them. And there are Muslim nurses, I think, at the moment working in Japan. And that's going to be the beginning of it. So there you go. There's Japan gone. I think South Korea is having the same problem. There's been a bit of rebellion against it in South Korea, but it's also being pushed on them too. So you're absolutely right, the Asian countries as well. The successful Asian countries, yeah.
Yep, yeah. They'll get it. And it's I saw some other thing, people who talk about, you know, Eastern Europe being a bastion. And in some ways it is. Mm-hmm. But the more the prolonged assault of this thing is, you know, the insidiousness with the EU was the free movement of labor throughout the EU. So you had a bunch of people from Eastern Europe going to Western Europe to fill their labor needs for, you know, to obviously drive down wages, and the same thing we've seen time and time again. And then all of a sudden there's a supposed labor shortage in Romania, and Romania saying, well, we might have to bring in 500,000 people from Pakistan, or Poland saying we need to bring in some Filipinos to fill this labor shortage. I'm like, Poland, a country of, I don't know, 50, 60 million people, has a labor shortage? I mean, that's absurd. So what are the conditions that are created? And they use the birth rates too, but never, obviously, addressing why the birth rates are lower. Why are there key shortages in certain areas? What exactly has created these conditions that conveniently necessitate more importation of scab labor from abroad? You know, that never think about. I mean, some of the Eastern European countries, again, that's why I say that in some ways I wouldn't say they're necessarily bastions, but they're holding out. At least the governments are trying, like in Hungary and other places, to address it and say, yeah, this lack of birth rates, we need to give tax breaks to young families. We need to make home ownership more affordable, that sort of thing. At least there is an attempt, but it's not necessarily the government that's, in those countries, that's the problem. It's the private interest, which is actually the case in most countries. It's the private interest. But if the private interests get their hooks in the government, which invariably they do in neoliberalism, the government eventually will just become, sorry to be crass here for saying, their bitch, and will just do what they want them to do. And so then eventually, if they have any restrictions on immigration, like the labor lobbies and the NGOs fit into this too. I mean, they're all on the same page. They'll say, well, you know, Poland, you know, your GDP has been increasing at whatever the percentage is, but, you know, you have this dearth of labor because so many people have gone to the UK to fill the menial jobs there the British won't do. And so you better make sure you get these 500,000 Filipinos in here to fill those jobs. You know, don't you want your economy to keep growing?
Yeah, the economy must keep growing, mustn't it? It all counts, you know, because it's so great with the economy growing the whole time, isn't it? It's had such great results in the West so far.
But yeah, hasn't it? Look at America. It's got, like, I think the stock market's at an all-time high or something like that. I don't even really keep up with it because it's just nonsense to me, but things are going so great.
The interesting things about the Brexit vote was, you know, that to paraphrase George Bush, you know, senior, it wasn't the economy, stupid, you know, to try and stop us voting for Brexit. They kept on screaming hysterically about the economy and still are. And people were just kind of like, you know what, we don't mind taking a hit. That's fine. We want our country back. And that's what the elites don't get, is that, you know, certainly the working classes have been suffering for a long time under this. And they're just kind of like, great, the economy's going to go bad. Is it? Oh, wow. So how's my life going to change? You know, not much. My life's pretty bad as it is. And the elites haven't realized that yet. I don't want to be naive about that. Of course, the economy matters, and of course, there'll be problems. But I think people haven't understood that, you know, the masses are prepared to go through a bad period now to get this sorted out. And the other thing you mentioned there, you know, Poland has to import people from Pakistan or whatever because Polish people are in England doing the menial work. That's right. And this is one of the problems with the welfare state. Again, I wouldn't get rid of it completely, but it has become too big in recent decades. And so it's become acceptable for English people just to refuse to do menial work and live off the welfare state. That shouldn't be acceptable. The welfare state should be there if you genuinely can't work, if you've just had a heart attack, if you've had your leg amputated, etc. It shouldn't be there just because you just don't want to work as a street cleaner or you don't want to work in a cafe. So this culture in Western Europe of sort of allowing people just to live on welfare all their lives has meant that we've had to have mass immigration. And mm-hmm. that's a cultural change that we need, you know? And I think that might come, actually. There are some good signs of hope in the UK at the moment. Well, not many, but there's a few smattering, tiny sparks of hope. Yeah, now you can see the beginnings of that a little bit in the UK. Some politicians are beginning to sort of talk about, you know, the need to work and the need to get off the welfare off welfare state and the fact that the welfare state just needs to get smaller and smaller. So you think, well, okay, you know, if that continues, then people are going to have to work. And that might reduce the need for mass migration. But then, of course, one of the problems we're having with mass migration isn't necessarily Poles coming here to work. It's the fact that there's, you know, 50 Iranians every day or whatever it is coming in by a boat in Canterbury. That's one of the problems we're having. And they just disappear under the radar here in London and probably aren't even here in any way officially. And that's a whole different kettle of fish. So,
yeah, they're not working. They're just there. Like they're not doing anything. It's crazy, but
it's just so reckless. All of it's so incredibly reckless, and you know it's not going to benefit the elites in the long run either. But they haven't quite realized that yet.
Yeah, I hope they get their comeuppance because it's really unacceptable. And I mean, you know, they don't obviously they're not concerned with or care about the future. I mean, many people have pointed this out, but most of the leaders, at least in Western Europe, are either gay and or childless.
Yes.
And is just right in the immediate. They don't have any long-term conception. They're just concerned with material well-being here and now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is definitely part of the problem. But the other thing, of course, happening in Eastern Europe with migration is it's part of the EU forcing it on them. The EU has decided that, you know, migrants will be shared, i.e. young Muslim men will be shared, because that's basically all the illegal migrants who are coming in. And they're basically saying to countries like Poland and Hungary, you know, you have to take X number of them or else we're not going to give you this fund or this allowance or whatever. So however much the governments are trying to stand up to it, they need the European funds because their economies are locked into sort of the European empire now. So they're sort of being, you know, they've got a gun at their heads with a lot of it, which is another reason why I think the European Union has to go. It's got to go at costs. And I'm hoping that Brexit will ultimately destroy it. But if it doesn't, then I think that these Eastern European countries are going to have mass Islamic immigration forced on them. And all the problems in Western Europe will happen there too. And your average Pole, your average Hungarian absolutely does not want that. They are under no illusions about what that means. A lot of them have come to Western Europe in the past 20 years and they are appalled by what they're seeing, you know. And they're going back to Poland saying, do not replicate what's happened in London. But, you know, they don't have much power either. So that's sad, you know. But, you know, I don't see the Poles, your average Pole, putting up with it too much longer, though, because the Poles are very Catholic. They're very traditional. They're very proud. They don't want this. And you hear sort of stories of, you know, gangs of guys getting together and kicking the Turkish kebab shop owner out of the village and stuff. I mean, I've never managed to kind of totally verify properly whether these things are literally happening, you know, but you hear stories about it. And it wouldn't surprise me if some of that is happening. So I don't think they'll put up with it. But again, you know, they can't repel it peacefully. That's the problem. It's not that people don't understand what's happening. Some don't, but a lot do. It's just they can't really do anything about it. And they can't do anything about it peacefully. And that's what's worrying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a lot of them, too, they are kind of to bring it back to the Turks. A lot of those countries are fully aware because they lived under Turkish occupation for hundreds of years. So imagine telling Bulgaria or Romania, hey, you know, these people who like kidnapped your kids and made them fight as Janissaries and who like harassed you and persecuted you for hundreds of years, you're going to have to take their young fighting age men.
This is it. And pay for them. You're going to have to work until you're 70 to pay for them. And you're just like, what's this about? No.
And, you know, a white pill for people listening is, you know, I've spent a lot of time in a lot of those countries. And like, I remember walking around one of the major cities over there with a friend of mine, and just seeing people's reactions to these guys just milling about in the park, like going up to them and basically my friend translating for me, the gist is basically, what, why are you here? You should leave before something bad happens to you. It's like, you don't belong here. You should not be here. Get out of here.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fair response. I mean, you know, they shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
What business do they have in there? I mean, Turkey, the Turks ethnically cleansed Anatolia of the Grecian and Armenian people. Yeah. So they have their own country to go back to. In fact, it's based on ethnic cleansing. So it's the same that way that I feel about Haiti. Haiti's like, oh, we need all this aid, France and stuff. It's like, wasn't your country literally built on white genocide? Like, how about you go fuck yourselves? And if you have such a great country or you're so proud, go back and build it. But they can't. And so then they come here and they try this faux. And so many people have been indoctrinated, as we have been saying, that they're like, oh, the Haitians, they've just had it so bad. You know, they've been really, you know, they've been crushed by this earthquake. It's like, well, Japan gets earthquakes all the time. Is Japan doing that? Japan had actual atomic bombs dropped on it, and it's doing very well. Germany got just utterly annihilated in the First and Second World Wars, and is still among the most robust countries in Europe, probably along with Britain. And, you know, so there's obviously something else to it. It's not that it's like they've been ravaged by humanitarian disaster, and that's true, and we're sympathetic to that. And it's one of those things where that's where you would have, as you had said, genuine human outreach. You try to help these people out, but then don't come around with the sob story about all these sorts of things and, you know, try to play both sides. They know that there's an advantage to doing it, though, and that's obviously why they do it. They know where the bread is buttered, so to speak.
And with Turkey in Europe, it's just utterly absurd. I mean, Turkey was the Christian Byzantine Empire. It was conquered and colonized by Muslim Turks, who then proceeded to conquer and colonize and enslave parts of Southeast Europe for several hundred years, and conquered the whole of the Middle East and had the Ottoman Empire. You know, Turkey is not an oppressed country. Turkey has not been oppressed by evil white people. None of this has happened in Turkey. Turkey was a vast empire, and now is not. Now it's a modern republic, and the Turks are fully capable of sorting out their own problems. We don't owe these people anything whatsoever. But because the mentality is so simplistic, it's so racially simplistic, everyone just thinks, oh, Turks are a bit browner than us, ergo they must be oppressed, ergo this must happen. We must, you know, allow vast numbers of them into our countries. And it's ridiculous. You know, the Turks are perfectly capable of realizing that if they keep on producing more children than they can feed, that they're going to have a problem. And it's their problem, not ours. And the Turks are perfectly capable of realizing that if they need to sort out their economy in some way, that they can do it, you know, but they don't, because it's easier just to sort of let the West sort it out for them. And I point this out to people all the time with Turkey, because no one seems to understand anything about Turkey's history. They don't even know it was an empire. They don't even know it colonized parts of Europe. They don't know about the gates of Vienna. They don't know how many times it tried to conquer right in the heart of Europe. They just don't know any of this stuff. And you just think, you know, the Turks, if anyone is the oppressor here, it's them towards us. We beat them fair and square and push them back. And that's what we should have done, you know, and that was okay. And we don't have to feel guilt of anything about that, you know. But again, people are just totally ignorant about it. Totally, utterly ignorant about it. So there we go, Turkey.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, we don't do ourselves any favor. We have this, the kind of in the U.S., and again, because our foreign policy has pretty much been identical for the last at least 20 years, probably longer, you have this whole bomb the world, invite the world thing, too. So you go, oh, well, you know, here we're going to go and invade the coalition of the willing. You know, we're going to go invade Iraq, and then we create these humanitarian disasters. And then we have to import the very same people we've been murdering on behalf of these defense contractors and these other big moneyed interests, and Israel. so that we're going and we're doing their bidding. And then we have to take people who resent us because in our name, our countries have been going over there and murdering them in the hundreds of thousands. And I mean, Yemen has had some ungodly cholera outbreak because of all their fresh water sources being just obliterated by Israel and Saudi Arabia with the aid we give them. And how long before we were told we have to take these Yemenis who are fully aware of our culpability? When I say our, I mean our governments, not us. Our government's culpability in their situation. Of course, they resent us. It's insane not to think that. But it's that idea. It's like, we just need one more war. You know, we need to be a perpetual war. We invade these countries. And again, like, what sane person is going to go, we've been in Iraq off and on for 20 years, Afghanistan, these countries, we've murdered, you know, people's brothers, sisters, parents, children. And then we tell them, yeah, come here, you know, and it's all going to be kumbaya. It's all going to be great. Yeah. And of course, it's not. Of course, it's not. It's madness to think otherwise.
And the most infuriating thing about it, certainly from the British point of view, is that we passionately did not want to get involved in the war in Iraq. I don't know if you remember, but there was the biggest demonstration that's ever been in this country to try and stop that war. There was literally, I think it was 2 million people on the streets of London. It was enormous. People who would never, ever demonstrate or get political. I mean, the country absolutely did not want to get involved in the war in Iraq. And lovely left-wing New World Order Tony Blair just decided he would do it for us. And exactly like you say, the rest is a disaster. And you can't explain to your average Iraqi that your average Brit didn't want this, you know, and didn't want to bomb their country, didn't want mass migration from Iraq or anything. You can't explain it to that. They don't get it. Why would they, you know? But that's one of the things that's most infuriating about it. And I think obviously the American military feels this even more strongly than the British military because they've been sent to endless wars they didn't want anything to do with, you know. I just wish some of them would start mutinying. That would be great, but not there yet.
True. No, and you're right. And I was old enough when all that stuff was going down to remember all the mass protests and things. And one of the most disconcerting aspects of the last 20 years has been the fact that the left, which was so staunchly opposed to war, is pretty much okay with it now.
Yes. Like
you know, you see, on the American side, you see Tulsi Gabbard running on an anti-war, explicitly anti-war platform, and she's getting just excoriated by both sides of the establishment.
Yes, very interesting to watch, isn't it? Very interesting. Yeah, the left have become precisely what George Orwell said they would become, and they don't have any understanding that that's what they've become. And that, to me, is the most sinister thing, the total lack of awareness, the absolute moral certainty and righteousness combined with the complete lack of awareness of how dangerous the path they're on is. Because you just can't make them realize that, you know, these ideologies, they're at the mild end of it at the moment, but where does it end? You know, if they keep on here, they end up in complete totalitarianism. And they just refuse to accept that's going to happen. But, you know, why would it not? That's happened everywhere else in all other times in history. And they're getting away with it at the moment, and all the no platforming and all the, you know, all the free speech stuff. I mean, I try to say to people, you know, we don't really have freedom of speech anymore in the UK. They look at me like I'm crazy, but, you know, the hate speech laws are so Machiavellian and so subtle that basically they can get you on anything, absolutely anything. And people are being convicted. You know what happened to Count Dankula, you know, the guy who had the Nazi pug joke, you know?
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, by any stretch of the imagination, that was obviously a piece of humour, very funny humour, and very British humour. I mean, British humour traditionally is always inappropriate and edgy and stuff, and it's a classic example of it. And he got done for hate speech, for heaven's sake. I mean, it was just absolutely absurd. But this is something that people haven't realised it's happened, because they still think, oh, no, we've got human rights in the courts and yada, yada, yada. But yes, but we've also got these laws that were brought in by Tony Blair and New Labour again. It's always them. Which just basically mean that any judge can just slightly interpret anything you say in any context to be hate speech. So that's it. Freedom of speech is gone in Great Britain, you know. And that's something that should worry people. But the left are not worried about this. The left just say, no, well, hate speech is not free speech. And then you're lost. You can't explain to them that there really isn't any such thing as hate speech. Not really, you know.
And it's an emotion anyway. It's subjective. So how do you legislate a subjective emotion? Well, very, very conveniently, it's in the eyes of the beholder, and the people that have power will just say this, well, this is very hateful. You know, it's the things that are allowed to be said about, look at like, I'm trying to think of some people like Afua Hirsch and some of these other clowns, like the things that they say about the British people, like, again, talking out of both sides, but these are not our values. You're not British, first of all, and you never will be. Because you're not like, you know, maybe I think like her dad was maybe or something, but like she's effectively not British, but is trying to tell British people what their values are and lecturing them on hate and even using some vile invective. And that's not hate, though, of course. But if you say, you know, I really object to the fact that I'm being demonized and all of these other sorts of things. And even if it's a pretty mild objection, they'll be like, this is totally unacceptable. And, you know. They'll do, like you said, they'll do you in for hate speech. I mean, it's thousands of people every year get arrested on things they say on social media.
They do
in Britain.
and they get visits from the police, and it's got a little bit more sinister than that. The police are now deciding that they will come and have a little chat with you for, let me get the words right, non-hate incidents? Is that the term you call it? It's something completely Orwellian. So it's not necessarily a hate crime per se, or is it hate-related incident? It's something more weird than that. So it's basically if someone just thinks that you might have done something because maybe there was hate, they will, whatever hate is, they will come and visit you. And yeah, I mean, you can just, yeah, there's clips all over social media of people, you know, recording police at their doors over this. And often it's just for something completely ridiculous, like, I don't know, making a joke, a play on the words of Ramadan or something, you know, it's something so innocuous. And they're getting visits from that. It's not like they're kind of saying, you know, gas all the Muslims and burn all the mosques. I mean, no one's saying anything like this, you know. It's all completely, completely mild stuff. And often stuff that's also factually correct about Islam, which is even more sinister. People are getting visits because they might quote something directly from the Quran, which shows what the Quran says. And then this is hate speech. And you kind of think, well, yes, it is, but not for me, you know. Yeah. But then they're getting visits by policemen saying, well, would you like to talk to an imam about this? I mean, since when did British police become sort of, you know, the barometers of sort of, you know, Islamic theology? But this is what's happening. So I think we don't have true freedom of speech anymore. I think, you know, we have to keep on pushing the boundaries and speaking freely and not accepting hate speech. But we are going to keep seeing people being prosecuted and put in jail for it. And I was absolutely shocked by the Count Dankula thing. I thought there's no way a judge is going to accept this and get thrown out of court. And then, silly naive me, the judge was like, yep, no, guilty of hate speech. So there you go. Yeah. Monty Python will get done for hate speech these days for that kind of sketch they did about, you know, the Germans and not mentioning the war. I don't know if you know that one. They get done for hate speech for that probably these days, you know.
They were ripping into John Cleese for saying London doesn't feel like an English city anymore. Well, because it's not.
It's just, and that's such, that should be a completely uncontroversial thing to say because it factually isn't. He wasn't even saying it was a good or a bad thing. He was just saying it isn't British anymore. And factually, it clearly isn't. Brits are 45% of the population here now. But no, let's absolutely get hysterical about it. One interesting thing, though, that I've noticed in the recent years is that when people like him say things like that now, yes, they get huge amounts of sort of screeching from the left, but they get huge amounts of support too. People have had enough of it. And I don't know if you saw just a couple of days ago, just in the aftermath of the Dayton and El Paso shootings, Rosanna Arquette put out some stupid tweet about how she was so ashamed to be white and something, you know, all the usual. And I mean, every single corner of the world just laughed at her and threw shit at her, basically. So I mean, and Black Americans were trolling her, and everyone was just saying, really, shut up, you stupid woman, you know? So much so that she went into protected mode and all this kind of stuff and gave up. And I was quite pleased to see that because I kind of thought, you always have to be careful using social media. It's too much of a barometer of social change. But I don't think you'd have seen that just a year or two ago, you know? And what amazed me was the number of people who are not white who were saying to her, stop being utterly ridiculous, you know? So that was quite good to see. So, you know, maybe slowly but surely people have had enough. But the elite's absolutely no way. And you talk about people like Afua Hirsch. I mean, she's a classic example of the sort of the multicultural British elite now that absolutely just thinks that they're the barometer of everything and sort of sits in splendid isolation in London. Although now I think she's actually working in America for a bit. But sits in splendid isolation in London lecturing us about, and basically all she's doing is just sort of saying the world must be exactly how I want it to be. It's just some precious, spoiled, princessy person, basically, who doesn't seem to have a clue about anything. And she's a classic example of someone who's classically privileged, you know, grew up in the most wealthy part of London, went to private schools, went to Oxford University, went straight into elite jobs, you know, classic example of someone who's never had to struggle in any way. She's just half brown, and maybe once or twice someone was a bit rude to her about it. That's basically it, you know?
Yeah, and it probably wasn't even a white person that was rude to her about it.
Well, it could well not have been, you know, because, you know, the racism comes from absolutely every direction, as we've discussed. And she's just awful. And the things she says about white people, especially white men, are unacceptable. But this is okay. Everyone just says anything they want about white men the entire time, and that's not considered to be racism. I go after them all the time, but, you know, I'm not part of the elite, unfortunately, so I don't have much power.
Well, it's one of those things, right? And then they go, it seems like young working class white boys are not doing that well. It's like, oh, I wonder why.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't possibly guess why they're not doing, and I'm sure it'll come for girls too, but the education system definitely is more biased towards the female learning style. It's just that boys take longer. It's just a fact. Boys take much longer to develop. And furthermore, they tend to be more hyperactive when they're younger. And so like, just give them Ritalin and just discipline them. And so it's like they're more active. I mean, they're biologically different. Yes. But again, the sort of, let's say the sex, bias of public schooling is also has a racial bias. So eventually, you know, it will start to affect the white girls as well. It probably is. It's not publicized, obviously, and nor is the sort of white boy stuff. They try to keep that under wraps.
Beginning to be spoken about a little bit in the UK. They're trying to not racialize it at the moment. They're trying not to say that they're failing because resources are going to other kind of racism cultures. But people are beginning to realize it. And in terms of the white girls, I can only give you an anecdote. I think I told you last time we spoke that my daughter's school, she's an absolute minority now. White people are about 20% of the population now. And certainly with the teachers there, I've noticed them basically just not really bothering with the middle class white children, because they assume, correctly of course, that I'll pick up the slack, that I'll do the extra reading, that I'll teach her about European history, that I'll make sure her maths are up to scratch. So they're basically just sort of like passing on teaching responsibility to the parents and focusing on the immigrant children or the ethnic minority children for their own ideological reasons. So they're not saying to, say, the Caribbean mother, you need to read to your child every day. Instead, they're not reading to my child in school and reading to the Caribbean child in school to make up for what the parents aren't doing. And that's not okay with me. You know, I'm very happy to pick up some slack. Of course I would anyway, but I shouldn't have to, you know. But that is definitely happening. And that's just anecdotal at the moment. But, you know, you speak to other white parents and they're just accepting that they're going to have to partially homeschool, I suppose, certainly home supplement the education, you know, because my daughter certainly isn't going to be taught anything about sort of British culture or British history. She's not going to be taught anything about the kings and the queens and the Norman and conquest or any of that. That's not done anymore, you know. She's already been taught about Malcolm X. She was told about Malcolm X when she was 7, but she hasn't been taught about anything else. I did hit the roof when she was taught about Malcolm X. I did make a formal complaint. You know, I was like, are you insane teaching 7-year-olds about Malcolm X, you know?
And what relevance does it's not even like your culture. That's kind of back to what you were saying with the one size fits all model. It's like, what does the American civil rights movement have to do with Britain? Precisely. I mean, maybe if it was a world history course when she's in high school.
This is it.
But
yeah, I'm happy for her to learn about him. But I would say even university, a very complex man, very complex period of American history. University is when you study it, not amongst 7-year-olds. But you might quite like this anecdote, though. It just shows you the absurdity of some of the ideology. So I was sat in on this particular lesson because it was Black History Month and I wanted to see, you know, how bad the indoctrination was. And it was worse than I expected. But anyway, so I sat in on it. So there's a picture of Malcolm X up there. And as you know, he's very white. Or very pale, certainly compared to Black Africans. So there's a little Nigerian boy in the class, and the teacher's there going on about, you know, Malcolm X being black and everything, and he just sort of quite innocently says, but miss, why do you have a picture of him up when he's white? He's not black. And the teacher got cross, and she went, he is black, it's Malcolm X. And then just moved on quite quickly. And I thought, actually, the Nigerian kid's got a point. You know, as far as he's concerned, Malcolm X is not black, you know. And I just thought it was a brilliant anecdote, you know. And the way the teacher was just like, oh, my God, that's it. No, 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 none of this, you know.
Yeah, that's heresy. Yes, heresy. You know, he's one of the saints of civil rights. You can't say that.
He's also telling this little kid that what he's seeing is not correct, and he accurately observes something, and he's being told he's not right about it. The kid looked confused afterwards. He was like, huh? You know? So I stayed out of it and just lodged that particular anecdote. But yeah.
And then they wonder too why parents pull their kids out of school or they try to put them in private school. It's because they want them to have an actual education, not what, again, an indoctrination. But then you have like in Germany, I think they've made it illegal, if I'm not mistaken, to homeschool your kids in Germany. So they must be subject to state sponsored indoctrination.
It could be Germany. I think certainly Sweden. If Sweden hasn't actually done it, then they're planning on doing it. Because yeah, Sweden is the most sinister of all the countries in Europe at the moment. But for exactly that reason, yeah, to make sure your child is indoctrinated and separate from you. Yeah. I would homeschool if I could. I'm not in a position to do it exclusively, but I would do it. Certainly at primary, because I don't like what I'm seeing. And I totally understand why lots of Americans are doing it. I've been looking into some of the homeschooling Americans recently. And yeah, exactly like you say, for all these reasons, they want them to be educated and not indoctrinated. And I don't blame them. But it's ridiculous that you've got people who are otherwise paying their taxes, living as law-abiding citizens, should absolutely be able to rely on the state to teach their children basic maths and literacy and critical thinking and a bit of science and stuff. But instead, they're not doing that. They're being forced to pay for their children to be indoctrinated and to hate them, you know? And one thing that concerns me a little bit is that, you know, my daughter is going to grow up in this environment, and at some point she's going to start to think, well, hang on a minute, you know, my mother must be completely awful because she believes all these things that my teachers tell her are not good. So is it going to cause a problem with me and my own child? You know, I don't know. But I know that already I have to be very careful about the things I say, because she's going to pick up on things, and it's going to conflict with, you know, what she's being taught in the school. And she's not old enough to understand these things yet. You know, you have to be well into your teenage years before you can start to understand issues to do with race and culture, I think. And I would say that as somebody who grew up all over the world, you know, I only began to really truly get it myself when I was a teenager, despite being grown up in an incredibly diverse environment. Children just don't necessarily think that way. So yeah, maybe that's something we're gonna have to worry about in a few years down the line, that our children are gonna start turning on us, you know. And let's hope that it's not got so bad that by then they're reporting us to their teachers for thought crimes. Let's just hope, but, you know,
could get seriously. Then you have to self-censor because, oh, my daddy or my mommy said this thing at home. And you're like, you know, then you get a knock on the door. Excuse me.
This is exactly what happened in the Soviet Union. I mean, you know, they get a knock on the door because, you know, your child had said something in the school. So that's what happens in all kind of totalitarian societies, you know. The children are used to sort of monitor everyone else. Will it get that bad here? Who knows? Who knows? You know, but it's I don't like it. I don't like it at all. And another example was, it wasn't just teaching them about Malcolm X, but this particular teacher has been talking to them about, she watches, the BBC has this program called News Round, which is aimed at children. And she makes them watch it every day. And it's just ideological propaganda, and it's all the usual stuff you would imagine. So she'll watch it, and there'll be a little item about the problem on the Mexican border. And so one day I'm walking home from school from her, and she literally said this. She was 7 years old, and she said, "Mummy, I want to talk to you about," I think she said, "the Mexicans." I was like, "Okay." And she went, "I don't think Donald Trump is being nice to the Mexicans. He's not letting them come into the country, and all his wives come from other countries too." My seven-year-old said this.
Oh, God.
That self, yeah? So I thought I was the roof, and I sort of then tried to explain it to her as well as I could. And I think, in fairness, she kind of got it. But I just sort of thought, why am I having to chat with my seven-year-old? Should I be talking to her about, you know, My Little Pony? It's just absolutely ridiculous.
The fact that they're politicizing kids is disgusting. I mean, I think probably high school is when I started to gain some views on things. You just don't get it. It's too beyond your capability.
And they're absolutely far too young, but it's happening. And interesting enough, I mean, we started off at the beginning talking about the problem in the schools with the Muslim parents not wanting the sex education thing. Now, on one hand, I was quite sympathetic to them because they were talking about basically teaching about transgenderism and sort of, you know, gay relationships and stuff to primary school kids. And my view there is that I'm all fine, do some of it, you know, in secondary school. But do primary kids need to know about gay people and homosexuality and sex? They don't need to know about this stuff, you know, when they're in primary school. So why is that? Why have we decided that we need to teach prepubescent children about same-sex relationships? We need to know what sex is, you know. So on that level, I was reasonably sympathetic, ironically, to the Muslim parents, because I just thought, why so young? Why are you exposing them to all of this so young? Just let them be innocent and let them play, you know. But no, instead it's just getting younger and younger and younger. And I think a lot of the people who are very concerned about sort of the transgender and the gay rights lobby, or the extremes of the transgender and gay rights gay white stop, you're saying the same thing. It's, I'm all for my daughter knowing that, okay, some people are gay and, you know, don't kill them for it. But I don't think she has to have it forced on her as this is an automatic good, you know. She should be able to discuss the complexities of it when she's a teenager and understand that, you know, not everyone thinks this way and, you know, in some parts of the world it's illegal and all the complexities. But instead, it's only being presented from the point of view of ideology to people who are far too young to understand it. And some people I know who have been sort of chewed up by the transgender lobby, you know, who thought they might be transgender and stuff and then realised they weren't. They sort of say that it's part of almost like the plan. They sort of say that if you get children when they're very young and screw around with their understanding of gender and sex, that, you know, you can really mess them up, because then they start to sort of think, well, you know, a little girl who maybe is quite sporty will then think, oh, well, perhaps I'm a boy, maybe I need to take, you know, testosterone and all this sort of stuff. When actually it's like, no, you're just like sport, that's fine, you know. So they some of them say it's even more sinister than that. I've not looked too far into that myself, but it wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
No, not at this rate. And the more they sexualize them, the more that creates, it kind of feeds into that consumerist. It's like a feeding stream for the consumerism, like, or a tributary. Like all this stuff eventually leads to, what do they call it? The woke capital. You know, it's sort of, I haven't published anything on this yet, but I'm working on some stuff about what the people, you know, the venture capitalists and stuff, they're calling philanthropic capitalism. It's basically like exploiting people's better instincts to make money off of them. So they say that, like, love is love. And then they just push the most insidious stuff under this headline, because it's like on the surface of it, you go, okay, well, if you love someone, you love someone. That's great. You know, that's not a, why is that something to hate, you know? But then then love is love becomes a lot of really weird stuff that gives them a lot of latitude to push things like kind of like, as you were saying with the sexuality stuff, like, I don't want my 7-year-old learning about any kind of sex, period, yeah. Yeah. Let alone like gender reassignment surgeries and all this other stuff. Like, they need to be probably, I would say, teenagers.
Yes. Absolutely.
Before they get exposed to, like, they're kids, they should be left alone. But and kids used to be off limits, but the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, they've been fair game. I mean, they've been working on them for a very long time in terms of advertisements between cartoons and things. And I go, hey, mom, I want this, you know, toy or whatever. But they realize they're, because they're so vulnerable, their minds are so plastic at this point, they can indoctrinate them with just really savage, just savagely horrible things. And then they come to believe it. And it's just, you know, like I said, these used to be taboos. Like, you don't touch the kids. And unfortunately, you can see them starting to push the pedophilia stuff. Like, it's
okay. Yes.
And
yes.
People go, well, you know, that's the, you know, you're building a straw man. Actually, I'm not. I mean, you do see this stuff. They are trying to normalize it.
Absolutely are, and under exactly what you just said, the love is love banner, you know, and you know, and it's absolutely repugnant. Certain things have absolutely got to be morally unacceptable, bar none, and paedophilia is one of them. But it's being pushed. You've seen TED talks by people sort of talking about how it's a natural psychological disposition that the poor things can't do anything about, and you know, all this sort of stuff, and more people talking about, you know, grey areas with child coming on to me. I mean, just disgusting stuff that you're reading, which just should be just shut down and shunned instantly, but is being allowed to creep in. And yeah, it's I don't know where it's going to end. But certainly the sexualization of children is very disturbing. I try to keep my daughter away from a lot of it, but some of her friends, her female friends, who have got otherwise reasonably switched on parents, I would say, are just really, I wouldn't even say sexualized, say pornographized. I mean, the way they dress, the way they walk, the things they talk about, you just think, where on earth are these little girls getting this from? I mean, my daughter's best friend was around a couple of weeks ago and decided she wanted to show me her dance routine. So I said, okay, fine, I know she likes dancing. I mean, she basically did a striptease, you know. I mean, she didn't take her clothes off, but it was just all this kind of like highly sexualized dancing. I mean, totally adult, you know, all this gyrating of hips and this sort of, you know, sultry look in her eyes. I was embarrassed. I didn't know where to look. You know, I just thought, what is going on? This tiny child is just doing some erotic dance here. I don't know if her mother knows, but I found it very, very disturbing. I remember thinking, well, first of all, where's she getting it from? How come her parents don't know? And then I also thought, well, if I wasn't who I am, if she did this in front of a paedophile, would they think this child is coming onto them? And would they do something about it? I found it really, really disturbing to watch. And certainly when I was 7 and 8, I did not do things like that. You know, I was out playing and watching, I don't know, Star Trek and stuff. I definitely wasn't kind of, you know, simulating sexy dances, you know.
That's a great point. And you're right that it is more, how did you say, pornographized?
Pornographized because they're yeah. sort of sexualized, but the images are so graphically from pornography at the moment, you know. It's all this really like, you know, lingerie as clothes, this kind of sort of come hither sultry look in all the girls' faces all the time, you know. It's just the next step up from sexualized, not just looking at them as sexualized beings, but like actively pornographized beings, you know. And then you look around at the images everywhere, and the images are all now sort of lighter versions of pornographic ones. Everything is being sold using this kind of very pornographic images. And it's just crept up slowly. I mean, if I think about, you know, when I was growing up in sort of the 80s and 90s, the fashion magazines, yeah, okay, they had beautiful women, you know, looking slightly sort of, you know, erotic and stuff, but they weren't as pornographic as they are now. It's just become more extreme, all of it. So whereas now it's not just a beautiful woman, it's a beautiful woman simulating some form of pornographic act, you know. Then you think, well, what's the next thing? A younger woman simulating a pornographic act. And then what? A child, you know. So you just think it's got worse and worse and worse. And you see it around. You see it around the way people dress. I mean, I don't know what it's like in the US, but in London, a lot of young people seem to think that lingerie is clothes these days. I mean, they just walk around wearing things. And I just think, you know, you've forgotten to put your clothes on, you know, get dressed. This is to be normal these days as well. So, yeah.
I think you really hit the nail on the head there. It's not even just, you know, sexualized. You're right. It's pornographized. It's like a performative aspect of what sexuality is. And it's like, porn is not sexuality. I mean, most people, like the situations and all these things, they're automatically, it's a cinematic form, trash, but cinematic in the sense that it's acting, it's play acting. And so people are play acting what is already play acting. And it's this just bizarre, it goes to that omnipresence of media, just warping the way people think and what they view as normal. And so they have these ideas of what it is they're enacting. And if you're 14, you don't understand that. You've got this narrative that you're receiving. You see all these images and incentives to like dress like a prostitute and think that this is somehow normal, and it's not at all. And you can see people are like craving, men with women and women with men are craving like just a normal, like good partner, because you have to be a jerk if you want to attract women. It's like, no, I mean, they're not looking for a pushover, but by the same token, you don't have to be a total asshole, and you don't have to like treat everything as though it's a transaction, you know, and everything becomes though the sort of, again, consumerist. It's like how many notches on your belt, all this other stuff. And but that is what's pushed on people. And then they wonder why they feel so empty and hollow. And like, you see people look like they've been through hell and they're 20 years old.
You do. And it's all a lie, because I mean, some of the most unhappy people I know, I mean, I'm in my mid 40s now, and some of the most unhappy people I know are friends who over the past 2 decades have done exactly that. They've thought, great, I'll just go off and I'll have loads of sex and I'll go to swingers clubs and I'll do all this kind of stuff. And look at me, I'm so crazy and edgy and liberated. And they are just the most unhappy, destroyed, hollowed out people now. And you sort of say, well, you know, do you see the connection between the two? Can you accept that, you know, one led to the other and that you were kind of lied to, a bit of a wild goose chase? One or two are beginning to accept it, but it doesn't work in the long run. And that's the other thing. You know, it's pushed on young people who then think, okay, fine, I'll do this. And then they do it. They don't kind of get on with anything more meaningful in their lives. And then they sort of, you know, they're not young anymore. And that's all they've got. And then they've got the rest of their lives just to sort of face. And you're seeing a lot of that too, which is another thing that makes me very cross about all of this, you know.
It is, yeah. And it's again, it all ties back to that consumerist aspect. And it's like, it doesn't matter if it's in the moment, like you're hearing the pop music, which I try to avoid, but every now and again, I actually will engage with because I'll talk about the content of it as propaganda, actually, or as advertising, sort of both. They're pretty much one and the same at this point. But the idea of like, they'll talk about brands and go out and, you know, oh, you might have to, you know, spend your rent money on going out and drinking and trying to get laid and all this other stuff. And it's like, it's just that hyper consumerist aspect. And then if you're alone when you're 45, I mean, as a male, childless and alone, like as a male, you still have a shot, but as a woman, like biologically, the odds of you meeting someone and then getting pregnant and the child being okay are like non-existent. Yeah. So at that point, you haven't taken advantage of your biological window to reproduce. And now you're like the supposedly the cool, why not? But you're still just buying stuff to fill the void because you have nothing there to invest in. So you're the perfect consumer because you're atomized, you're alone. And a lot of times these people are embittered. And for those that don't see the light, they actually, it's kind of sick, but a lot of them you see actually try to like drag other people down with them and even convince like younger women that this is a good thing. They basically, it's kind of like liberals with this really infantile worldview of equality. Like they keep pushing the idea. They keep doubling down on the idea, even though they know in their heart, I would hope in their heart of hearts, they know that it's wrong. But misery loves company, right? And so it's like, well, you know, don't you want to be like me and, you know, be an alcoholic? cool. Why not? Who's like totally miserable. And, you know, like, I mean, I just don't get it. Thankfully, I don't get it.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of the women who do exactly that. They leave it too late. Then they get to exactly like you say, mid-40s with no children. And one or two decide to make the best of what their freedom gives them. But most do not. They become very embittered and nasty. And yes, absolutely, some encourage others to do it. How or where they are they're doing it, I don't know. I think some it is sinister. But, you know, it's even worse than that. I mean, if you try to tell a young woman nicely, you know, think about children, do really, because you will want them. And tiny numbers of children, women genuinely don't, but virtually all women do. And they look at you like you've just told them to go and get Ebola or something. I mean, it is that bad with young women these days. I mean, where I work, has been a recent new batch of recruitment of 20-somethings. And I raised this conversation with just one of them. And she was like, no, I don't have children. I want to do this. I want to do that. And I sort of said to her, well, think about it, because you might change your mind, yada, 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 your biological clock. Mentioned the biological clock, and then it was like I was oppressing her. And no one's oppressing you. This is simply biology. There's nothing to do with fairness here, you know. You just have to accept this. This is going, you know, if you want children, you should have them now. But they don't listen, and you can't make them. And I think that will start to fall apart, a bit of that, because I think even Generation Z, a little interesting sort of social research on Generation Z, you know, the ones born since the millennium and how much more conservative they are. And it seems that they're kind of observing this and noticing it and realizing that if they want to sort of have families and children, they've got to get started younger. And the other thing about it is it's quite brutal, but it's sort of Darwinian. I mean, these women aren't having children, so they're not passing on anything. Whereas the people who are having children and are passing on their values don't think the way they do. So in a way, you kind of think, hopefully, it'll just sort of die out, this sort of excessive feminist culture.
I think you're right, actually. I've said that before, that I think in some ways we're in an evolutionary bottleneck. Yes. So like, who's susceptible to their propaganda? Who is sort of too credulous for their own good? And they basically, their genes will just die out. And the people who are not strong enough to resist it, like, that'll be that.
This is it. The one thing that worries me in the interim is that these women are in senior positions in education, media. So whilst they're not raising their families, they are indoctrinating our children. So that's one of the problems at the moment. Well, they're in human resources, you know, making sure the hiring happens. So that's one of the danger zones. But they will die out. And that will be interesting. Yeah, I think I read a statistic which fascinated me, which may or may not be true, but it sounds true, that the two fastest growing populations in the US are the Amish and the Somalis.
Good Lord.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought. And I thought, wow, now there's two incompatible cultures. But it's quite interesting. I'm sort of segging away a little bit from feminism here. But I just sort of thought, well, these are two cultures that are indeed, you know, quite traditional in very different ways and having lots of children are therefore growing fast. Now, you can't see a happy ending between the Amish and the Somalis. But that is, I raise it more just to sort of say that, you know, the future belongs to the people who have children. And, you know, the blue-haired feminists are not having children. So, there is something good there. And I'm not opposed to all feminism. There was a part of some of it that was okay. It's just become this monstrous multi-headed hydra that's lost control of the plot, you know. And yeah, I mean, before they die out, they will push transgenderism and hatred of white men and all these sorts of things on our children. That's the only thing. So we have to be aware of this and try and balance it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on the feminist question. The idea, like, you see a lot of people saying, well, you know, we ought to just roll it back to like 1700 or something. And it's like, well, you know, I don't know about all that, because there's plenty of valuable contributions women are making. I think a reasonably traditional structure is ideal, but I don't think it means that you just like, and to some degree, that's been very exaggerated in the history, the degree to which women were marginalized in Western cultures. Because, again, there's a nugget of truth in a lot of this propaganda, like the idea that Western cultures have actually been more inclusive than others is actually true. Yeah. And it's not like the way that they frame it, though, is it's like they take advantage of this instinct that we have to be more sort of collaborative and more open. And then they just try to guilt you with, you know, in the past, you know, women were totally marginalized. They were men's property and stuff. It's like, well, how do you explain Queen Elizabeth? How do you explain Catherine the Great? How do you explain, and a lot of it's a class thing too, of course. If you were an aristocratic woman, you had a lot more sort of latitude and leeway. And yes, of course, there'd be arranged marriages and things, but there were major power brokers. And even if you go back to like Roman times, the Germanic tribes, the women were on pretty much more or less equal footing with the men. I mean, they had very separate spheres in which they fell, but you'd have like stories of the Germanic warriors going and they would take their whole families to the battle and their women would be like screaming at them, but you know, go fight harder, you pussy. They'd be like guilting them into it's great. It's so cool. And you know, they had a say at their gatherings. And you know, there are many things like that that are just, they try to bleach it out of history and they say, no, women have been super oppressed. And it's like, okay, well, they don't have carte blanche to do literally whatever they want like they do now, but there was much more equality than you're led to believe. But I also, again, I don't think the solution then is to just go full Sharia law and throw everybody in a burqa and say, shut up, you know, and then have them all as concubines. I mean, that's preposterous too, but some people want to go that route. And I just think it's like, all right, well.
I mean, I agree with everything you said, absolutely, and all of it also just forgets the fact that, you know, it's been pretty miserable for your average man throughout history too. You know, think of your average working class man from the north of England working in coal mines, you know, 6 hours a day, you know, who's oppressed here, you know? So it also forgets that, you know, oppression or hard times happen to both sexes. But I think a friend of mine put it quite well with feminism, which was just that feminism should always have been about liberating alpha females to do what they want. But most women are not alpha females and don't want to be. And I thought that was quite a good way of putting it, because yes, you mentioned people like Elizabeth I, but also, you know, those people like Marie Curie or Florence Nightingale, sort of people. And these were formidable women who found a way around any restrictions and contributed, genuinely contributed. But, you know, most women are not like that. Most women are not Margaret Thatcher. You know, your average woman, and you should always be in a society where you can liberate a woman like Margaret Thatcher, sure, because she was formidable. But, you know, most women are not like her, and they don't want to be. And one of the things I think is so awful about feminism is making people there's something wrong with them if they do want to live more traditionally, if they do want to be mothers and raise children. They have to be embarrassed about that. And that is what is ridiculous about feminism to me. Well, that and the pretending that men and women are the same, which is just idiotic.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, I keep saying this, but again, it's this consumerist there. If you're basically the same, i.e. interchangeable, it's the same thing with this whole equality bullshit, then you're interchangeable in the economy. You're just widgets in the economy. I mean, think about that's pretty much the sort of like getting women in the workplace. The whole design is just to drive wages down to flood the labor market. And then also you break all these traditional ties. And I'm with you. I mean, there's probably I don't know what the numbers are exactly. It's probably, I don't know, 5% of women, 10%, something, a minority, small minority. But those are active, dynamic women who are meant to be CEOs and these sorts of things, who should be out there and be able to pursue their passions. But for the vast majority who don't want to, they shouldn't be browbeaten into conformity and say, like, no, you shouldn't want to be at home with your kids and cooking and, you know, making clothes and all these other things. And those, they, the incentive structure is such to, like, bash on those people and say, like, oh, well, that's not being liberated. And it's like, actually, for most people, that is being liberated. They don't have to go and slave away in some BS office while you have the cruel cat lady lording over her and waiting for her to say one wrong thing to report her to HR. Get her, you know, it's like, that's not liberation. That's horrifying. That's like dystopian hell. That sounds terrible.
It is. And, you know, what happened to valuing womanhood and motherhood? Feminism would have been much better if it had tried to do that, sort of, you know, elevate the status of women rather than try and change women. There's a great quote from C.S. Lewis that I really like. I'll get it a bit wrong, but he basically says, motherhood is the ultimate career because all other careers are designed to support it. And you think that's correct. I mean, we do everything, we exist, and everything we do is to have our young and raise them. And motherhood is absolutely key to that. And as a result, it should be valued and should be respected. And I personally would have preferred to see feminism try and elevate that more than trying to denigrate it and convince women to leave it, because that has not worked. I mean, we are absolutely primed to want children, and women who deny that, it doesn't work out well for them. It's very, very upsetting to see. But we're well into three generations of it now. And yeah, all these young women just don't really understand even what they are biologically, which I think is one of the most disturbing things to see. They do think they're the same as men. They don't think there's any difference. And, you know, by the time they realize, a lot of them, they are too late to have children. And, you know, IVF and stuff is not the solution for all these people. So, you know, they've been sold a pup, as my father would say. You know, they've been sort of, they've been led down the wrong path.
And that's the diversity thing too. Like you're saying, you're celebrating, supposedly you're supposed to be celebrating differences. Well, men and women are different. And so they pit them in opposition. If it's they're always trying to do things on multiple fronts. Like if they're not pitting them in opposition, they're saying you're exactly the same. So it's like you're exactly the same, but you're set up in perpetual antagonism. And so that and they wonder why people go crazy because of all this mixed messaging they're getting. But men and women are complementary. And again, there's more sort of effeminate men, and there's more sort of masculine women, and there's more women who are type A, and more men that are not more women, but there are women who are type A, and there are men that are type B, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, but the idea is you kind of, you want this interchangeability where, you know, and what's weird about it too, is then on the, they're trying to sort of make women more masculine, say they're just like men, but by the same token, they're also trying to take men and turn them into women, either literally through the transgender stuff or through dietary things, like, and have them basically have a lack of testosterone. So they're weak and ineffective and sort of more compliant in what they're trying to push. So it's this kind of like odd thing that we're witnessing where they're trying to masculinize women and feminize men. And it's just, you're seeing all this, it's really grotesque manifestations of it. You're like, this is just, the average person is going, something is deeply wrong here. This is very unnatural, but unfortunately they've been, it's kind of, to go back to your Orwellian point, they've been deprived of the vocabulary to express that.
Yeah.
What they're witnessing is totally wrong.
And what I find fascinating about it as well is that, you know, women despise men like that. They don't want to be with them. And this, so it's almost like this kind of like double kind of like joke on these men. They're sort of being forced to kind of be all kind of feminist and effeminate, and then being told this is the way to be successful, and this will make women like you. And women don't like men like that, you know. They're not even necessarily conscious of it sometimes, but they don't. And so you get these men that kind of do all the things they're supposed to do, and then get rejected by women, which understandably then I think makes them extremely angry and bitter. So this causes another problem then, you know, and that is rooted in the fact that we just won't be honest about what we are biologically. I mean, it's got so ridiculous. It's not just that we have to pretend that men and women are the same, but you're not allowed to pretend there's any rankings or differences. So the other day I just mentioned, I can't remember who we were talking about, but I mentioned that somebody was a classic alpha male, and they kind of looked at me just like, you can't use a term like that anymore. And I was like, what do you mean? He is, you know? And that was just absolutely unacceptable. You can't possibly say that, that such a thing exists. And you're like, well, they do. And doesn't, you might not want it to be the way, but it is that way, you know? And you cannot remake the world, you know? And you cannot remake what we are as a species. It's like, you know, the mammalian kingdom has them. We have our silverback gorillas and we have all of this, you know? And it's not exactly replicated, but it is, you know, similar in the human mammalian system. But no, even that I'm not allowed to talk about anymore, because that implies difference. That implies that, you know, some men might be stronger, others weaker. We can't have that because that might make someone feel bad. And so that's how bad it's got in terms of people self-censoring. You know, we can't even use a term like that without some form of censure. You know, I mean, I will continue to use them, but that's what's happening.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you can't acknowledge. I mean, there was a We talked about the military very early on. The idea you have, or I don't even, that might have been before we started recording. That's how you know it's a good conversation, when you don't remember when you hit record. But they ran some like war game simulations with mixed sex units, men and women, the U.S. Marines. And the ones with that were mixed sex, and it was either, the control was men, and then they had, the test group was men and women. They didn't have like all female units. But the mixed sex units, and I use sex intentionally, I'm trying to avoid using gender, just because I think that it's been so corrupted. I mean, I do quote in my normie life, whatever. But anyway, so the mixed sex units had 6 times the casualties.
Of course.
Obviously with strength disparity, but I would imagine that there is a thing when you get a bunch of men, particularly alpha men, together in a group that happens with bonding that simply cannot have, and a level of trust that simply cannot happen if there are women around. And I would imagine with the female units, there's probably a similar process. I mean, you'll still have the physical differences, but there's, I don't know enough about it. Maybe there would be some cattiness and it would be worse. Possibly. I don't know. But you can't fully let down. That's why they're used to be, and they've sort of eliminated. And I'm speaking just from my perspective as a guy, but like these male only spaces are becoming fewer and fewer. So you can't have that opportunity to just sort of bullshit and bond and hit those, you know, have that kind of camaraderie.
You're absolutely, you know, that's exactly what's happening. And you've even got now women being allowed into elite and special forces units in the UK. I mean, they have to pass the training, in fairness. They've got to be obviously pretty tough. So I think the first woman just joined the Royal Marines, I think, last year. And okay, she made selection and stuff. But my view on that is, can't there be somewhere where you just have men doing what men do traditionally, and alpha males doing what they do? There should be somewhere. And you know, you talk to soldiers who would serve in those units, and they would say that yes, you know, of course it would, exactly like you say, completely change the dynamic, and that they would be thinking, I've got to protect her or something. And I just think, even more fundamentally, there just should be a point at which we just say no. You know, it doesn't matter if one individual woman is capable of passing out as a Royal Marine. We just shouldn't have them in it. We just say no. But there's never this saying no to anyone anymore. You know. And I think, you know, it's going to fundamentally weaken the armed forces, and that's also part of the plan. It is weakening the armed forces, and that's very dangerous, because they're being weakened at a time when we need them, you know. So I wouldn't go so far. I mean, look, I don't really care either way if women are allowed in the military or not. It wouldn't bother me either way. They are at the moment fine. There are certain jobs they can do, especially with, you know, logistics and so much stuff being done by drone and stuff at the moment. But, you know, elite combat units, it's like, really, do we really have women in elite combat frontline units? And if so, why? You know, no one's asking that. No one's asking the why. Is it necessary? It's, everything's been framed in terms of, well, she has a right to, she has a desire to. You're not allowed to oppress her for stopping to do it. But
no, I agree.
So we've just got to get it out of the way, and then we've got to start to kind of refound our real British values, which are genuine freedom of speech, which are absolutely the right to offend, with raucously outrageous comedy and drama and stuff, and all the things that, you know, Britain used to be good for. We've just got to get back to it. And your average British person does still want it, but they're just being browbeaten, and they're just confused as well. You see your average person who's perhaps not as engaged as us and not on Twitter and stuff, and they just don't know what on earth is going on in the world anymore. And I felt the same way, because after my daughter was born, for about 5 years, I just wasn't that interested in politics or anything, and just sort of, you know, didn't pay attention. And then by the time I re-engaged a few years ago, the thing that first struck me as, you know, something weird is going on, was when I heard about Germaine Greer being no platformed by feminists at university. I remember thinking, Germaine Greer, feminists don't want what? What's this about, you know? And it was over something said about transgender people. I just couldn't get my head around it. And I'm pretty political. I'd like to think I'm not critical about things. I just thought, what is going on? Germaine Greer can't possibly be a problem for feminists. And then, of course, I started, you know, red pilling myself, and the rest is history. But that was the first time I realized something was up. And, you know, I do still speak to friends, you know, old school friends who aren't particularly politically engaged at the moment. And they are just bewildered by what is happening. They're good people. They don't want to offend anyone. They're not racist or any of these things. And they're just kind of like, why are people telling me I'm a Nazi? And I try and explain to them why. And they just don't get it, you know. And these are perfectly intelligent people. So that's the other thing. The whole kind of mainstream country is being left behind whilst this kind of cultish elite sort of imposes this ideology on them. But, you know, it won't last forever. The issue, as I said before so many times, is just at what point it breaks and at what cost it breaks. Because it's going to break. It's not going to work. It just is not going to work.
And that's one thing that it's frightening to see, the sort of radicalization in some ways of so Britain. Unfortunately, you guys are in the same position that we are, in the sense that though you may have more parties, they're really all basically saying the same thing, except one is kind of catering more nakedly to Muslims, and which is kind of like what we have. but like the idea is basically, it's like there's no, you had said this earlier, there is no real right as such. I mean, the Republicans, or the so-called conservatives in the United States, basically exist to get wrecked by the left. So whatever the left kind of puts out there, and it's kind of like they'll say, oh, well, you're racist. And they go, whoa, and they'll tear themselves to pieces trying to prove that they're not racist, instead of just saying, like, okay, like, first of all, that word doesn't mean what it used to mean. So it kind of going back to very, like, racist to me means basically what you described at the outset of the episode of the way men would treat you guys in Turkey.
Yes.
Or the way these guys treat women in Europe. And, or, you know, here, wherever they happen to be, really, as opposed to, you're not on board with our sort of, you know, you're not on board with us basically using you as a cash cow and guilting you and trying to, you know, basically make your life a living hell to serve our purposes. Therefore, you're racist. It's like, well, that doesn't really work like that. So I took you there, go like, my favorite thing to do is just go, okay. Or just say, what do you mean by that? What does that word mean? Because it doesn't mean what it meant even 20, 30 years ago. They've changed it. So it still has the connotation of like KKK, but in people's minds, because when they hear it, they think, oh my God, you know, and obviously it's like, well, we want to condemn that. And then, but what they mean though, is like, you're not totally on board with our agenda of like giving your kids sex hormones. Like, you know, and it's funny because they'll use racist and bigoted, and but they use them all like in a string. So even if you call someone racist now, because they're using the word association, it evokes sort of like homophobic and stuff too. So it's just become so expanded. But at some point, I would think anyway, I would hope it loses its power and it becomes sort of a nothing word where people use it to the point where, again, it still has that sting to it at the moment, but it encompasses way more things than just even race, as I said. But the hope is that it kind of just keeps expanding past that to where it's just nothing. And people hear, they go, okay, like, what does that even mean? Like, I don't, you know.
We are approaching that, funnily enough, in Britain anyway, because one thing, you know, Britain is not a perfect country in any way, but I would say that it is not particularly racist and never particularly has been. And I think the evidence for that is that people of all kinds of colours have succeeded in every single strata of British society. I'm not saying that there hasn't been racism, that there aren't particular problems, but basically you can be fine here wherever you come from. And people see that now, you know, and you can't, I mean, I'll give you the example. When Boris Johnson took over a couple of weeks ago, he appointed all kinds of ministers from all kinds of ethnic minority backgrounds. And he genuinely did appoint them because of who they are, you know. I mean, I know who these ministers are. I know why he picked them, you know. And you'd like to, in a way, it ought to have been the success of multiculturalism, absolute truth that here you have a cabinet that people of all kinds of colours and religions are being appointed on their ability only. That should be what the left claims it wants. But instead, the left went absolutely hysterical because they weren't the right kind of brown and black person. They didn't think the way they did. They were Uncle Toms. They were coconuts. They were oppressing. They were supporting colonial, all the usual nonsense, you know. And everyone just laughed at them, basically. I mean, everyone was just kind of like, this is absolutely absurd. You've always said you wanted this. Now you've got it. And now you're still not happy. And so people were kind of trolling them, saying, oh, you know, what are they? Are these fascists of color? Are these like the wrong kind of, you know, person of color? And it just didn't work, really, because most of the country had no problem with it. Most of the country was like, yeah, fine. We've got, you know, ministers now who are fine. And no one really cared that they were brown or black. The only people that really cared went on about it were the left, who just didn't like the fact they were brown or black, but right wing, you know, not brown, black and left wing. And that just shows their bigotry and their racism. It's just kind of like, what, do you think black people aren't capable of being right wing, you know, because they are.
Yeah, you see that with some of the Trump people. They're just savage with this guy, Ben Carson.
Oh, yes.
And it's like, well, you know, they're just like, well, he's not the right kind of black. It's
yes,
like,
exactly.
Well, okay, well, what do you mean by that?
But that is being used a lot, or the left is using it a lot in Britain, and it's not working. And it's also not working because a lot of, you know, brown and black people are just kind of just saying, shut up, go away, leave me alone. You know, I don't have to think the way you do. And I'll believe what I want to believe. So in a way, the kind of the fight back is also coming from them. I think I mentioned last time I spoke that one of the communities that I think are going to be quite influential in the future in the UK are the Nigerian Christian Conservatives, because they have no time for the left, and they have no time for anyone trying to pretend that telling them they're oppressed. They don't seem to care in the slightest about people being racist towards them. They couldn't care less. They're just too busy getting on with their lives. They came to Britain because they want old Britain. They like the constitution. They like the laws. They like the queen. They like all of it. And they're kind of just saying to these lefties, just, you know, what are you talking about? I'm not oppressed, and I'm perfectly happy with England. And no, I don't think I'm a victim of colonialism or any of these things. And the left go crazy at them because they just think, no, you're not saying the right things, you know. And these people are increasingly doing very well in this society now. Some people aren't happy about that, but that's what's going on. And they don't have any time for it. So that, I think it is losing its power. I mean, for the last 3 years since Brexit, all the left have done is screech racist and Nazi at us. And that's it. That's the only argument they have. And they've kept on doing it, and they're still doing it, and no one's really listening anymore, you know. No one cares about being called it anymore. More often than not, you see people just laughing at it and brushing it off, or trolling them back instead of saying, okay, you want racism in this country? Well, sure, there's rape gangs up and down the country of Muslim men raping white children. That's racism. Do something about it. And instead, they're hiding it and covering it up. So again, this cognitive dissonance is just getting completely out of control, and it will break at some point. So I've got some hope on that level. But again, you know, it's not only the left are still there, and they are still causing huge problems. So they are going to continue to use this word and this term, but it will become meaningless. Psychologists call it an extinction burst. You know, when you use something to death, and at the end, before it's about to die, it goes completely hysterical, out of control. And I think that's what's happening with the left. They are losing comprehensively across the Western world, and they're getting absolutely hysterical. And they've got all the institutional power and all the funding at the moment, and they're throwing their weight around, but it's not working, you know. We are still voting in right-wing parties. We are still, you know, leaving the European Union. All these things are still happening, and they can't really do anything about it. They can screech Nazi ass for as long as they want, but that's not going to change the fact that we go in and vote for parties that they don't agree with. So one small sliver of hope.
Well, you're right. It's making them apoplectic, because they're like you said, we control literally everything, and we can't get the majority. We can't get the majority of people on board. It's like, yeah, because your ideology sucks. People just don't like it.
This is it, you know. Most women don't want to neglect their children, you know, so they can go and work 10 hours a day. And, you know, most people don't hate their husbands. And, you know, most people don't look at your average white man and think, oh, my God, you are personally responsible for 500 years of colonialism. People just don't think that way. They do, but most people don't, you know. And that's sometimes, you know, the benefit of kind of unplugging yourself a little bit, I think, from politics and social media, and kind of getting out amongst normal people. You're like, oh, actually, most people are okay. They're not too bad, you know.
You just get kind of the extreme voices. Well, mostly from their end, amplified, because they just kick everyone off that they don't agree with. But yeah, you get a skewed sense of like, this is what, I mean, that's what the power structure thinks. That's what the people in charge and their little pets think. But the majority of people don't like it, don't want, they find a lot of the stuff particularly like the sexual, the pornification. Is that how you said pornification?
Pornographization is the word I use.
Pornographization. Okay. I need to file that away because it's just perfect.
Yeah.
It's perfect. It's a perfect description of what's going on. People are repulsed by that.
They are
repulsed by it. And that's on their agenda. And again, they unfold all this stuff too. So it's like they're kind of their own worst enemy in a way too, because they've sort of prepackaged this ideology. And so they're like, well, you need to be on board with all of it. And it's like, if you object to one thing, they want to perform, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? They want to excommunicate you from their thing. And you go, well, okay. I guess I was okay with, but then people, the wheels start turning and they start going like, well, I guess I was okay with this other progressive stuff, but I'm not really okay with them injecting hormones into kids and stuff of that sort. And then, but they push them away and they try to ostracize them and they attack them. And then I think that a lot of people kind of, they have that come to Jesus moment where they go, wait a second. And they realize what the whole thing is built on anyway. It's all, you know, it's all lies and it's fraudulence based on control.
I think you're right about that. And they have overreached the left. And I think absolutely, like you pinpointed, they've overreached with the transgender thing, because that is just too far. You know, I mean, everyone will accept that throughout history, you've had people who cross dress or who have wanted to be the other. And most societies have made space for them somehow. But this attempt to sort of, again, pretend that there's no difference, that you can switch sexes and what they're doing to children is genuinely horrifying most people, because most people have children and most people know how obscene this is. And the left have gone too far with it, way too far. And it might be the hill they die on, really, which would be kind of ironic for them. But it just,
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too, because, you know, I would not ever want to be cruel to somebody who genuinely does feel stuck in the same body, but nor am I going to start pretending that this person can be the next, that can change, nor am I going to change my whole society for this person. And this is what's become so disturbing, this idea that the whole society has to restructure itself around the fact that a small number of people who on the whole are very damaged think they can change gender and do what they want with it. We've all got to change because of this, you know? And that, I think, is just really, really disturbing people. And you've only really got to show people a few examples of what some of these largely men wanting to be women are doing to just absolutely horrify people. I mean, I think I mentioned before we were recording the Canadian guy. He goes by the name of Jessica Yaniv, but his name is Jonathan Yaniv. And he's decided he's a woman, and he's decided he identifies one legally, I think, because you can do that in Canada. And he goes into children's girls' bathrooms, but when there's teenage girls there, and he tweets about trying to take out their tampons for them. I mean, this man is a complete pervert, a total degenerate. And, you know, he actually tweets publicly about this. And he's also now started to go around small beauty salons, usually ones that are kind of run at home, largely by quite poor immigrant women. So he's targeted Muslim women and Sri Lankan women, going in as a woman for waxing. And then, of course, he appears and he's a man. And then he's demanding these women wax his balls for him. And these women are saying, no, they don't want to be forced to touch this man's genitals, understandably. And he is then suing them under human rights legislation. And the Canadian state and the human rights lobby are behind him on this. And this is just obscene. Okay, he might be a particular extreme example of it, but he's an example of where this all ends with this human rights enablement of these people. You've basically got this highly damaged, very dangerous man, very openly predatory towards teenage girls, taking photographs of himself in bathrooms with teenage girls around, talking about, you know, tampons. And you just think, no, your average person is not going to put up with this, saying that this is this man's human rights, you know. I mean, this man should be sectioned and should be under special psychiatric care. He should not be having the human rights industry and the Canadian government supporting him. And I've been interested to follow his case, because absolutely no one, from what I can gather, is behind him now. So again, maybe by supporting people as extreme as this, they've really, really lost the plot, you know. This is not compassion to somebody who wants to be a woman. This is enabling a dangerous, dangerous person, you know. And it's been done under the guise of human rights. And human rights was not meant for this. Human rights was meant to sort of be fundamental about, you know, basic human dignities and freedoms. It was not about enabling extreme perversions like this. So,
yeah, you're right. Everything's a human right now, too. That's another. It's kind of like, you know, I'm always trying to find the through line, I guess, right? But this idea of like everything's a human right. Migration is a human right. It's like, actually, it's not. Like, a country, a sovereign nation has the right and duty, actually, to its citizens to determine who comes in and who does not. Absolutely. And you can't just, well, you can, apparently, depending on the country, walk in and set up shop and then start shitting on those people and then demanding they give you stuff. And, you know, I mean, yes, it's allowed to happen, obviously, in our countries because of it benefits the power brokers. But, you know, this is kind of a basic point, but one that I think should be made. I mean, imagine if we just decided to get like a settler colony and just go to like Ghana or something and just set up. And then we get there and like, excuse me, you guys are being insufficiently, you know, welcoming to us. And you also need to give us 35% of your wages and you need to like build us this stuff. And if we're not happy with what it looks like, we're going to riot. Like, kind of like, I've seen a couple of stories from Italy of migrants rioting because they haven't been happy with the type of house that they're in.
Yep.
It's like, well, these clearly are not people fleeing for their lives. You know, the saying beggars can't be choosers. I mean, it's like if you were, and there are actually lots of people out there who are in genuine fear for their lives of persecution. Many of them, by the way, Christian or other religious minorities that they don't give a shit about. And a lot of them persecuted as a direct result of our foreign policy. Those people, you know, whatever, they're left to their own devices. But then you have these other people who are just economic migrants, opportunists, parasites. They come and they're complaining because they don't have sufficient Wi-Fi. It's like, what kind of refugee? I don't know too many refugees that are concerned with, you know, whether they're on 3G or 4G or whatever. I don't even know.
This is exactly it. Yeah. This again comes from the human rights lobby because they basically managed to fudge the whole issue of migration vis-a-vis asylum. And like you say, yes, your average decent person would give shelter to somebody genuinely seeking persecution, but migration and a better life is not part of that. But the way they get around it is somebody who is an economic migrant just appears on the shores and files for political asylum. And then a legal process then takes place and legal stages have to be gone through before you can determine, is this person a refugee and deserving of shelter, or is this person not and should be deported? But this takes years. It takes a huge amount of money. It's challenged and all this sort of stuff. So everything just gets wrapped up in the courts and all time and energy and money spent on that because we have to, they all pretend that they are seeking asylum and they're not. I mean, the Mexicans are the classic example of this. They come to the US border and claim they're seeking political asylum, but that should only be if they're persecuted. They're not persecuted, they're poor, you know, and that's not, you know, poor, being poor might not be very nice, but it's not persecution. And you don't, and Americans don't have any obligation to poor Mexicans, you know. The Mexican government has an obligation to poor Mexicans. But once they've applied under asylum legislation, they're into the asylum refugee system, and then that takes forever. And that's exactly what's happening in Europe too. All these kind of West African men, you know, land on the shore saying they're seeking political asylum. And they're obviously, you know, economic migrants from Nigeria and Senegal. I mean, it's obvious. Yeah. They admit it, you know, but they apply for it. And then there's so many NGOs and human rights organizations are so well funded that will just, you know, look after these people indefinitely, really, you know. And that's where
young and healthy with their iPhones and their Nikes. And it's like, does no one think this is weird?
Strapping young, strong men, all of them. I mean, virtually all of them. 90% more is all of them. Any boat you see, it's just full of strong young men, you know. Way stronger than your average European man as well. You know, your average European kid's not going to win a fight against these guys. Not anymore. Not after all the, like you say, all the hormones and then the beef supply and the water supply and stuff. That's just not going to happen. I sometimes have some success waking up some real liberals with that. If people with sons, and I just, if they talk about the violence in London, and I say, what charges do you think your son's going to have in 10 years time against these people? And you see their face slightly change, and then they realize that they don't want to go too far down that route, you know, because you say to them, it's going to be your son's attack. You do understand that, don't you? You know, yourself.
Yeah, like they don't have to deal with it at the moment, but their kids will.
Their kids will, absolutely. And their kids are not being raised to be violent. And, you know, their kids are being lectured about toxic masculinity. Their kids aren't going to the gym and learning martial arts, you know. So unfortunately, they're going to be sitting ducks, some of them. And again, in the next 10, 20 years, that's going to become apparent. It isn't yet, but it will become apparent. Yeah, but it's all human rights. It started off so well and it's ended so badly, and that's a shame. I don't think it had to have been that way, but it has ended up that way. And we just, one of the debates here in the UK is if we leave the European Union, do we also leave the European Court of Human Rights? And I desperately hope we do, because it's that court which is preventing us from being able to deport a Somalian gang rapist, you know, because he has human rights, apparently. So, we actually cannot deport people from our own country because of the European court now deciding that his human rights are more important than ours. And that's got to change. It's just got to change. So I'm really hoping we leave that as well.
I'm inclined to agree, and obviously. And the idea that you'd have international organizations which collaborate with each other to help people is great, is a noble thing. And I think we're totally in agreement on that. I mean, there are people that genuinely need help, and it's the same thing with like welfare. What's the saying? Charity starts at home.
Yeah.
So you're just going to splash a bunch of money all over the place from people who are in the country working and supposedly paying into a fund to help their fellow citizens, and you're just going to import people to give that to? That's crazy.
It's crazy, yeah. And it also will reach a point where it isn't sustainable, because fewer and fewer people are going to be working and paying taxes, and more and more people are going to be living off it. So the center can't hold. You know, it will reach breaking points. And all sorts of people, even kind of left-wing people I know these days, are getting sick and tired of the amount of taxes they're paying. So, you know, when you start to sort of hear it from even the left, you think, well, maybe there is hope. And I always try and sort of point out, well, where do you think all these taxes are going? What's it all being spent on? Because the military's collapsing, the police is collapsing, the education system's collapsing, so it's not going on that. So where is this tax money we're paying going for? You know, think, make the connection. But they will at some point. But the thing is, you know, once people are in the country, what do you do about it? That's ultimately where we're at, you see. Certainly in Europe, with the level, the extent of the mass migration, certainly from Islamic countries, what do you do with whole colonies of millions of people, you know? And this is it. This is why I think we're headed for Bosnia and Lebanon-style wars, because I just think that's where it ends up. You know, that's where history shows us it ends up. And that's a terrible thing to have done to the United Kingdom.
It's terrifying. I mean, have you ever heard of Revilo or Revilo Oliver?
I haven't. No.
He was an American classics professor, and he was aware of this stuff and some of the betrayals that went on in World War II. He was in the Naval Intelligence, but he wrote a lot of stuff that was published posthumously. And one of the things that he had seen coming was what's happening in Britain. But he was writing in his private memoir, I think it was like in the 80s or something. Like he, all the way back then, he could see it coming, and the same thing like with the United States. And, you know, there've been other people like that too. I mean, Jean Raspail with Camp of the Saints in the 70s, like there's certain people, visionary people who have seen this, but people are so complacent. And I think that's really one of the things, the reason the Soviet Union and communism was ultimately defeated is because people had to deal with, deprivation. They had to deal with hardship. And the thing about neoliberalism and consumer capitalism, at least at the moment, is people have it too good.
Yes.
And say, well, you know, I'm comfortable, and they've got their bread and their circuses, and so they're fine. And like, it doesn't matter if Boko Haram set up shop next door, they're sort of basically fine. And I believe we talked about this in the last episode we did together, but once a few like barristers' kids start getting groomed, and a few people like the middle class, the upper middle class, start getting affected by this stuff, you'll start to see some change. But like, to what end? I mean, will they be allowed to exert any kind of influence? And at that point, when you start seeing these fracture points, and it's kind of like we were talking about with the gay lobby and the Muslims, like, how is the left going to reconcile this? Because we're already perfectly, by we, I just mean like regular nationalists, normal people, are pretty well reconciled to our beliefs. Like, yeah, we allow for some leeway for people who are non-white and, you know, like within some manageable amount, you know, like that's, and I kind of get shit for that a little bit occasionally, like, well, you know, why don't you want a pure ethno state? I'm like, well, because there's 150 million non-whites in America. Like, how are you going to pull that off? Like, let's be realistic for a second. But there are genuinely people who do share our values and those things. And yes, they're a minority of non-whites and quite a small minority in some cases. But, you know, allow for some latitude, being reasonable. But we're generally generally reconciled to our position. We understand where we're coming from. We don't have all these. There are some kind of weird fracture points, like I mentioned there, but like how pure is the, you know, the ethno state at this kind of like weird, ridiculous internet arguments people get in. But the average person understands implicitly what a nation is, what a country is, what a high trust area looks like. And when you say, people euphemistically will say like, well, the schools are better there. You know that they mean it's white people or Asians too, actually, to some degree. They actually, in the US anyway, commit less crime. Than whites.
In the UK, it's the same. I mean, you know, the schools everyone wants to go to are in the areas which are obviously white and middle class, or else have the Hindu immigrants because they're very pro-education, or as I mentioned, the conservative Nigerians. The East Asian immigrants who are very, very hardworking and, you know, impeccably behaved children and stuff. And exactly, that's where everyone wants to send their children. And it's a culture thing. I mean, again, I go back to the point where I don't think your average British person cares a huge amount about race, not fundamentally, not when it comes down to not if they're not being harmed by it. It's more, I often use the term culturalist, because it's really more about culture. It's about wanting to be around people who are just similar to you, have your values and behave the same way, or in a similar enough way. And yeah, everyone gets it. I mean, everyone, you know, is trying to get their children into the same schools, the same small groups of people. And as I said, again, East Asians, you know, Asian Hindus, conservative Nigerians and white middle classes. Everyone wants their school to be, their children to be in those schools, because those are the ones that have the particular cultural values they want.
Yeah. And they don't get that. Unfortunately, a lot of them don't get that those are outliers. So they'll say like, well, you know, the Sikhs seem to have, you know, assimilated pretty well. It's like, yeah, but that is a minority. Like, it's not like though the Sikhs have also been hit pretty hard by the grooming stuff too.
Exactly. Very much. And for the same reasons, because historically the Muslims looked down on them as dirt. You know, when the Muslims colonized India, they horribly persecuted the Sikhs. So there's historical oppression stuff going on there. But try telling that to your average white left wing person. They have no idea what they're talking about. You know,
absolutely. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Or they'll see in Nigeria the Muslims slaughtering Christians. It's like, or the Coptic Christians in Egypt. Or in, like, I have a dear friend of mine I'm trying to get to come on the podcast. She's very reluctant, but she's a Druze from Syria. Yes. And she's experienced she's very pro-Assad, because Assad protects the Christians and the Druze and the other religious minorities from being annihilated. Yes. And in the areas where ISIS gains a foothold, those people are all slaughtered. And if you look, most of the Middle Eastern Christians don't exist anymore. And that's a 21st century phenomenon, specifically because we decided to go in there and start taking people out. And I'd love for her to come, like, she's very reluctant, but I'd love for her to come on and talk about her experiences there. And also, her family's originally from the Golan Heights, so I'd like for her to talk about Israel too. But I don't know. Maybe Mossad will probably take her out if she has to talk about what they're doing in there. But the idea here is that, like, they... Like, it goes back to this really reductive paradigm that people have. It's like, oh, you know, they don't understand, even though they talk a big game about multiculturalism, they don't understand even the nuances of all these other cultures that they're talking about and that they're bringing in. And then they wonder why there's conflict. We talked about this between Caribbean immigrants and African immigrants and all these other, they don't understand the cultural differences between these people. They don't understand that, for example, in the Caribbean, sort of like in Islam, the Caribbean culture is very, very homophobic. I mean, there was a controversy not long ago, this guy Buju Banton in Jamaica, the dance hall scene, they're virulently homophobic. Yeah. It's like Boom Boom Bye. It's about killing gays. Yeah. Like they but they don't know. They don't understand that. They don't know anything about it. And they pretend like they're citizens of the world, but they don't know shit about the world. So they don't know anything.
This is exactly it with the left. They are so naive. And it's a paternalistic form of racism as well. They're basically looking at anyone who is brown or black skin and just thinking, aren't they kind of sweet and simple? And they don't have the same issues we have. And you're kind of like, that is actually racist. You're saying to these people that they're not capable of kind of, you know, thinking the same way that you do or having kind of complex thoughts and emotions. That's how I've always seen it anyway. Because you're basically saying that they're kind of simple little people. And you're like, they're not. They have the same problems as everyone else. They have racial conflicts and they have xenophobia, and they prefer certain cultures to others, and they don't like certain religions either. And you know, but they don't see that. And I go back again to the Nigerian Christians. They're some of the most outspoken people about Islam in this country, because they are properly Christian. As in, they know what Christianity is. They're not just going to come out with a, but what about the Crusades kind of thing? You know, they'll actually sort of talk, you know, theologically about the differences between Christianity and Islam. They absolutely know how dangerous Islam is, because they're being slaughtered all over the place in the north of Nigeria. And as I said before, they really don't care anyone thinks about them. So they're some of the most outspoken people about Islam. They're allowed to be at the moment. How long that will last, I don't know. But no, you're absolutely right. The complexity is not seen. And you're also absolutely right that the outliers are always focused on. The Sikhs being the classic example. And that's a classic, what I would call a journalistic plot, that ploy, that you take the exception and you base the whole narrative around the exception and then pretend that everyone is like the exception. And what it should do is look at the Sikhs and go, okay, what is it that's unique about the Sikhs that have made them integrate and be so successful here? Let's look at what's unique about them. What is it about Islam that means that Muslims are not integrating and being successful? But then you've got to contend with cultural differences, and nobody wants to do that, you see. Because that's uncomfortable. Then you start to pretend that certain cultures are better than others, or certain cultures are incompatible. And again, nobody wants to do that. So instead,
yeah, no, that's so true.
Yeah. Because I think, to an extent, you know, the multicultural horse is bolted. And I think, you know, you mentioned people who want sort of, you know, white ethno states and stuff. And the only way they're going to get that is by unbelievably savage wars. And I don't think it's even that necessary. There are ways that we can balance some of this out and rectify the worst of it without having to go that far, if we were just braver about looking at culture and at values and about enforcing certain cultural values and not allowing others. Then we wouldn't have the problem to such an extent. People often talk about the Salman Rushdie affair in the late 1980s here. You know, Salman Rushdie, and if you know about him, he's an Indian Muslim writer, or of Indian Muslim origin, but, you know, very much an English intellectual type. And he wrote a book called The Satanic Verses in the 80s, which I've never read, but apparently there was something not complimentary about Islam in it. And Muslims all over the UK rioted, and it was under the Thatcher government, and no one really knew what to do about it. Everyone was a bit like, what is this? You know, why are you also upset about this? And this is the country which, you know, allows any amount of insults towards Christianity, so we didn't get it. But everyone backed down. Everyone kind of thought, okay, fine, defended the Muslims, you can't do that. Salman Rushdie had to go into hiding for at least a decade. You know, he had police protection and stuff. And what should have happened right then and there was people said, I don't care if you're offended. If you're offended, you're living in the wrong civilization. You know, this man can say anything he wants in this book. He can say anything he wants about your prophet and your religion, and you just have to put up with it. But instead, we backed down. And since then, it's just been this constant case of backing down to this very intolerant culture. Whereas that was the perfect example of saying this intolerant culture, no way, you stay here, but you adapt to our rules. But we didn't do that, you see. And now we're adapting to burqas. And now we're adapting to sort of, you know, sex segregation at political meetings and stuff, because, you know, it's their values and we can't offend them now, can we? So, you know.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's always us having to capitulate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's how it always ends.
Yeah, always.
Well, I think that's probably a good end point, don't you think? Unless you have any last points you want to make?
No, I again can talk forever, so you better shut me up. I'll talk about anything, but yeah, no, that's we're talking for a good 2 hours, so we can leave it there. We can talk again if you like.
That's a good convo. Yeah, I'd love to. Absolutely. And as I said, you're one of the most requested, most popular guests. So I'm sure people would be delighted to hear that. I think that would be fantastic. This is a very Philo European show as well. lots of European guests on. I'll tell you what, I've had guests from 5 continents on the show. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. One of them is not from the continent, but they live in Asia. But guests living in 5 continents, I just need someone from South America. So if there's any listeners out there interested,
interesting.
That's my multicultural tokenism. Come on. No, I'm just kidding.
I'll see if I can think of someone from South America. I don't really follow people from South America. If anyone comes across, I'll send them your way. But there are people all over the world, you know, thinking the same way as we do. That's one of the things I love about social media, actually, is that you can connect with these people in a way you simply never could before. And then you do sort of realize that actually there's plenty of people who think the way we do. One anecdote before I go, I did some writing about my family's experiences in Rwanda and Rwandan genocide recently. And for some reason, it went viral around two countries. It went viral around India and Nigeria. So I got all these Indians and Nigerians writing to me. And one thing that was interesting about it was that none of them had ever heard about Rwandan genocide. And that I thought was kind of fascinating. But the other thing was just the level of the way people were so appalled by it, and they sort of implicitly understood, they sort of implicitly understood the issues behind it and the dangers that caused it, and how they're being replicated as well with this enforced multiculturalism in parts of the world. And I was quite impressed by that, because it was obviously two very, very different countries. But everyone was basically sort of saying this is a good warning. And it wasn't this kind of schmaltzy thing of like, let's just pretend humans are all the same and it doesn't happen. They were understanding that you've got to be very careful about bringing different cultures together and being very careful about how you manage it. And again, I was quite hopeful about that, because that's against the narrative that we normally hear. Everyone just thinking, well, the way you stop this is by absolutely stopping all kinds of racial or cultural difference. Instead, I saw people getting it. I think all over the world, people do realize and think much more similarly to the way we do. They're just not ever given a platform or interviewed or respected when they do, you know. But virtually everyone from both these countries was writing to me about exactly that. So,
I think that's a great point.
Yeah.
And I think it's good, because what people realize, I mean, in our countries, obviously we're the indigenous population, we're the population, and we're in favor of all people having a homeland where they're unmolested. So it's like, it's not a surprise that there are non-white people who appreciate what we're saying, because they've grappled with issues of colonialism. They've grappled with issues of multiculturalism. So they understand. We're basically just saying, look, we don't want people smash together who hate each other and have to live on top of each other just so that a few people can get rich. Like, that's basically what we're saying. And who hate us is also part of it. But the issue is, like, there are black nationalists, white nationalists, Arab nationalists. Like, we don't want those countries to be wrecked. I'm as committed to the sovereignty of you know, any of these countries as I am. Well, I shouldn't say as committed, because I'm committed to my own first and foremost, obviously, in my own people, but like, I am committed to the same principles of, like, the people who are in these countries who are being oppressed shouldn't be, and the people who are being subjected to all this stuff shouldn't be. And it's like, it just so happens they say they want to pin everything on us, say, oh, the evil white man and white people. It's just an ideological tool, and the people who are in those countries, as you mentioned, they get it, they understand. They both have had to grapple with giant Muslim populations who are hostile towards them. They've had to grapple with colonialism. They have the same issues in their own way that we are, I want to say self-imposed, but not really, as being imposed by our rulers on us. And they get it.
And the other thing that's been interesting as well is quite a lot of people, from overseas, from outside of the West, are also increasingly basically kind of on our side. They're kind of saying, guys, what are you doing? Why are you letting this happen to your countries? Your countries are good, you know. Sure, yes, you've had empire, served lots of people. There's great things about your civilization too. Why are you letting it be trashed? And that, I think, is very interesting as well. The one, you know, often comes to mind the most is that Catholic guy, Cardinal Sara. I think he's from Benin or something. He's in line to be one of the next popes. I mean, the guy is completely alt-right. You know, you should get on the case with him. He's totally and utterly in favor of the West and the West remaining the West. And I mean, he is always basically saying to white liberals, you are complete idiots. What are you doing? You know, and it's great when someone like him says it, of course. He's got no time for people telling him he's oppressed, because, you know, his country might have been colonized by France 100 years ago. You know, he's moved on from this, and he wants to see the West survive as the West. So there are people out there like that as well, you know, and I think we just need to sort of connect with them a bit more. And like you say, help them to preserve their countries. They can help us to preserve ours, and we can still get a bit more sensible about this stuff, you know. That's what we
absolutely.
We'll be a bit more sensible. But there we are. Let's leave it there for now. We can talk again. Okay, well, good to talk to you, John, and I will speak to you next time.
The biggest moment said.